Dot org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to use it besides riding a dragon into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking to our good friend Erwin Aronson about the election, what happened, what kind of bizarre things popped up, what kind of weird little stories he's got. Plus, where do we go from here? What does labor have on the horizon? What fights are we going to be looking for? I'm telling you right now, for me, I think the number one fight, and it's like the Republican brass ring. If they can figure out how to do away with project labor agreements, if they can go back and undo prevailing wages, if they can privatize the state liquor stores, it will be happy times in conservative land. Why? Because they can stick it to the working people. They can keep putting you down and keep sticking in the back. Why? So the wealthy can have more. That's why. So that the investor class can have more. That's why. Also on the program, Heather Kronk, Managing Director of Get Equal. We're going to talk about what progressive groups should be doing from now forward. I've said, look, the jobs have got to be here. They told us that if we stop with the regulation, we stop with the taxes, we stop with all this stuff, jobs would come flowing to us. Full employment almost should be immediate. Should happen overnight because, look, we've been building up these businesses. We've been handing them money. They're sitting on $1 trillion in cash. Right now, corporate America is sitting on $1 trillion. Now that the regulatory stuff is done, now that they don't have to worry about, because, you know, the Republicans, that's what they said. You know, if it's this uncertainty, it's all this uncertainty that they won't create jobs. And what I find interesting, and I'm telling you right now, if we don't start seeing these jobs being created immediately, we're talking about a flawed system. Also, Adam Hirsch, economist from the Center for American Progress, going to be talking about the conservative world. Where are we going from here? What are they telling us they're going to do? And to be honest, they're telling us they're going to do what they've always done. Give handouts to very wealthy people, deregulate, and privatize. And you've seen how well that's worked. But evidently, they're the flavor of the month. Evidently, their campaign trickery and their flash and their marketing skills have gotten them in office. Now the tough part, now the hard part begins. Governing. That's the difficult part. The difficult part is making people's lives better and making them know that you've made their lives better. As our president has seen and as the Democratic Congress, or what was the Democratic Congress, what they found out quickly. Our report from the Borowitz report, Canadian immigration officials have reported a huge increase in the number of requests from Canadian citizens in the past 24 hours, with over 55 million such requests since last Tuesday. Of those 55 million requests, well over 99.9% of them came from U.S. citizens, a particularly large number coming from Florida and Kentucky. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Lawrence Cannon, said that he was flabbergasted by the 55 million-plus requests for Canadian citizenship, adding that it was difficult to pinpoint the precise reason for the staggering increase. He said, "My only theory is that after the 2010 Winter Olympics, the sport of curling finally started to catch on." He cautioned, however, that it is impossible to know exactly what is sparking the sudden interest in America's frozen neighbor to the north, saying people are answering our immigration hotline say that it's hard to understand many of the American callers because they're sobbing uncontrollably. In other news, responding to last night's election returns, Representative John Boehner told reporters, I'm so stoked, I just turned the tanning bed up to 11. But former Alaska governor, the quitter-in-chief herself, Sarah Palin, struck more of a somber note, saying that despite several key victories, it was a tough night for Tea Party voters because it involved so much math. And that is the Borowitz report. I love Andy Borowitz. And the other thing that Sarah's got to be unhappy about is, you know, the woman who was too stupid to touch herself lost. And I think that's a good thing. So now we can focus on the important stuff, getting her behind bars where other people can touch her. I think that's important. But yesterday, the president was spot on. A major, major shellacking. One of the worst shellackings the worst in the history of this country. So what happened? Obviously, the Democrats didn't get enough votes. And obviously, they didn't get their people out to vote. And every poll that you saw said, well, you know, everything could be off this time because the young people have cell phones. And the young people, they're not in the polls. Well, you know what? The young people didn't vote. Less than 20% of people under 30 bothered to go to the polls. So all that talk of, well, you know, the polls, all these polls could be off by, you know, 5, 7% because the young people will come out. Well, it didn't happen. And can you blame them? Because they were told that their lives were going to be better. They were told that immediately things would change, and they bought into the media construct. They bought into what the mainstream media was shoveling. And they go, hey, my life's going to get better. We're going to get health care. We're going to, you know, going to have an economy that's going to work for everybody. We're on the right track. And what ended up happening, along the way to paradise, you ran into the party of no. And the party of no stood their ground, said, hell no. We won't go. Led by the Limbaughs and the Becks of the world, what we saw is, I want him to fail. And you saw this petulant party of recalcitrant Republicans who, like a 2-year-old kicking and screaming on the floor, did everything they do to obstruct, block, and delay. And get used to it, because it's going to happen for another 2 years. Because they're not going to get their way. But I'm saying right now they should be, right now, they ran on a platform, and they should stick to that. And I said yesterday, H.R. 1, in the first day of the 112th Congress, January 3rd, when they take the reins, so to speak, H.R. 1 should be to repeal health care immediately, if not sooner, undo completely, and let's start the discussion right off. H.R. 2, as I said yesterday, do away with all regulatory reform. Go back to the good old days where the casino was open for business. Right, I mean, Wall Street, of course. And the roulette table was there, and that little thing with the craps and all that. Let's make Wall Street friendly for the senior citizens. You know, might as well. In fact, it'd be a great place to put our Social Security money. So I want to see H.R. 3, privatization of Social Security, because this is what they ran on. So if you're going to run on it, you should follow through on it. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you really think H.R. 1 is going to be taking health care away from people? Do you really think their H.R. 2 is going to be, oh, yeah, here, go ahead. Go ahead, Wall Street. Go ahead. Do you think so? And do you really think they're going to run on privatizing Social Security? I mean, they whispered about it. They screamed about it. It was everywhere. You know, Pat Toomey and his, I'm sorry, Senator Pat Toomey, going to have to get used to that. Personal accounts. You can personally be responsible for your own account. Didn't that work so well with the 401ks? Well, this is what they want to do. This is what they want to do with Social Security. What I find interesting is that Rasmussen came out with a poll. And it's amazing how these polls come out. But Rasmussen writes, hold the celebration. Most voters expect Republicans to win, expected Republicans to win control of the House of Representatives on Election Day, but nearly as many expect to be disappointed on how they perform by the 2012 elections. So what they're saying is, yeah, we voted for them. We voted for the bums. We know they're going to drive us into the ditch. They know, you know, they're going to stick it to us, but we're going to vote for them anyway. A national telephone survey found that 59% of likely U.S. voters think that at least somewhat likely that most voters will be disappointed by Republicans in Congress before the next election. And I'm going to say, you know what? Bet on it. It's going to be higher than 59%. I'll bet your bottom dollar. This is coming. Because look, once you pull back the curtain, once you see what's not there, ideas, vision, leadership, a clue, once you find out what's not there, all those things, you realize this is the same old Republican Party. These are the same folks who got us into this mess. So as I said yesterday, today starts the resistance. Today we begin to organize. Today we begin to come together. And we talk about how we're gonna stop this. Because the next, here in the state of Pennsylvania, with the Republicans controlling the governorship and both chambers of the legislature, we have got a lot to do. And there's a lot of work that has to be done, and it has to be done quickly, which only means we have to organize, we have to come together. And that's why I'm asking you, our listeners, get involved. This is not a part-time, hey, I'm going to do it a couple months before an election, or hey, I'm going to ramp up before a big event. This is year-round, 52 weeks a year, 365, 24/7. This is what's got to happen. And we have got to stand and fight this, because they are going to destroy this state. They are going to destroy everything that we've worked for. They're going to hand away our natural resource. This Marcellus Shale thing has gotten me nuts, because we're already paying the tax. The tax is already going into the pocket of the investor class. And we're not seeing any of the benefits, and we're taking on all of the risks. And I'm telling you, it's dangerous stuff. Tonight, that's what we're going to be talking about. A bunch at your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you're near a computer and you want to watch us, just go to The Rick Smith Show. You can see us on the Ustream account right there on the website. But today, that's what we're going to be talking about. We want your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with our good friend Irwin Allen, right back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
SEIU Vice President Mitch Ackerman says the defeat of so many labor-backed U.S. House candidates was not a reflection of the true will of the majority of American voters, but the result of a concentrated corporate-funded campaign that capitalized on continuing economic pain.
This is the result of an unprecedented amount of unregulated, unreported corporate cash in these elections. This is not some sort of groundswell of enthusiasm for Tea Party and right-wing candidates.
Ackerman says despite the losses in the U.S. House, workers and their unions will continue to fight for what all workers want.
People voted for change 2 years ago pretty overwhelmingly, and it's not like the ideology of American voters switched 180 degrees in 2 years. It's that people are still hurting, and, you know, they're going to keep seeking ways to get some relief to the pain, and we're going to be out there trying to hold politicians accountable to creating good jobs in our community, to putting people back to work in the kinds of jobs that can support a family and help people send their kids to college and help us retire with dignity. And that's what working people want.
Ackerman says SEIU's national political effort scored some success in turning out the vote.
Places like Colorado, and we're celebrating the victory of John Hickenlooper for the governor's race. We did it in Nevada. Where, of course, the race was just called for Harry Reid. We did it in California. We did it in Arizona.
The National Labor Relations Board believes the Regis hair salon chain violated federal labor laws over potential anti-union activities. Jesse Russell reports.
The company's CEO, Paul Finkelstein, produced a DVD for employees in which he threatened the closure of salons if employees voted in favor of union representation. And he even went as far as telling workers they would be blacklisted in the salon industry. Posters were placed at salons encouraging employees to call a hotline if coworkers observed union activities, and the company even asked employees to sign pledges to not sign union cards. Regis has 12,700 salons around the world, making it the largest. Storefronts include Cost Cutters, Master Cuts, and a number of beauty schools.
Now that the state of New Jersey has rejected the ARC tunnel and the federal government has $3.3 billion to invest somewhere else, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is trying to arrange for it all to end up in New York State. In a letter to Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, Gillibrand asks for the money to be invested into the Second Avenue subway project in Manhattan. Part of that project will require the MTA to invest in upgrading the infrastructure of 51 buildings along the subway's line. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, that's what we got to do. We got to get started. Enough crying in your beer. Enough with the tears and the frustration. Now it's time to say, okay, lick your wounds and come together and start fighting from this day forward. This today, as I said, this is where the resistance starts. Funny story came. Voters in the Metro Baltimore area were treated to a moment of false reassurance. All is well, be well. Robocalls yesterday came from a 202 number. In a very soft, mellow female voice, told voters, "I'm calling to let everyone know that Governor O'Malley and President Obama have been successful. Our goals have been met. Our polls were correct, and we're okay. Relax. Everything is fine. The only thing left to do is watch on television tonight. Congratulations. Thank you." That went out to a lot of voters, in the hopes, of course, that we could somehow hold that down. Hope it didn't work. But we got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the phone, who did watch some of the polls and did see some of the shenanigans. And I want to talk a little bit about that and then some other things. Erwin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I appreciate you coming on. What happened yesterday?
Well, working people came in second in a tough election. And that happens from time to time. It's not pleasant, it's not fun, it's not joyous. But it is part of the cycle, and we have our sleeves rolled up, and we're going to keep on working and keep on fighting and keep the struggle alive and come back tougher and stronger than ever.
So where do we go from here? I mean, I'm already hearing the whisperings that privatization is on the horizon. I'm already hearing the whisperings that the state liquor stores are on the chopping block.
Well, there's lots of things on the horizon. They're always on the horizon, but we have a little bit of a voice and a whole lot to say about the horizon. And everybody always needs to remember that the voice of working people is not a voice of Republicans. It's not a voice of Democrats. We are a political force. We're not a political party, and we'll be there in the legislative halls, and we'll be there in the press. We'll be there in the media. We'll be on picket lines if we must. We have a simple message to all those who will voice and give voice to regression, and that is we will fight you. We will fight you in the press. We will fight you in the corners and corridors of the General Assembly and the Congress of the United States. We will never give up. We will never give in. We will never surrender. We will never say die, not today and not tomorrow and not while we live and breathe.
I love that talk, but how are we going to do that? How are we going to start from this day forward to begin to protect? I mean, really to protect our rights, one, and to protect what we fought for. What would you suggest?
I suggest doing what we do best and what we did so very well yesterday, and that's reaching out to working people, union members and non-union alike, and tell the story issue by issue, community by community. Neighbor to neighbor, day by day. You're absolutely right. Things like the state liquor stores are on lock, and we need to explore that issue. That's a wonderful issue that you raised, and it's one that we need to focus on with some immediacy. There is a certain convenience in the minds of those who say no taxes, not no new taxes, but no taxes at all, to close the budget gaps that they have created by not properly funding things like public employee pensions over decades by a one-time quick fix. But we need to understand something about the liquor store. The Pennsylvania State Liquor Store System is a corporation in which you and I and everybody listening in Pennsylvania tonight are shareholders. It's a very successful corporation. It's a corporation that has 3,000-plus family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining wages and family-sustaining benefits operating in virtually every community in this state. It's a corporation that is really and truly, in fundamental respect, the model of corporate responsibility. It reaches into these communities and does the right thing. It assures the public purposes that are always articulated about making sure that underage people don't get access to alcohol. It makes sure and absolutely certain that people who are in no condition to be drinking don't have access to alcohol. It is safe and secure. I mean, after all, when was the last time you heard of a Pennsylvania liquor store getting held up or robbed on a Saturday night like we hear about the bottle shops in New Jersey right next door to us getting knocked off every weekend?
Yep.
On top of all of that, the liquor store system brings in $300-plus million every year, year in and year out. That means that I pay $300 million and my fellow Pennsylvanians pay $300 million less in taxes every year. It is a huge tax subsidy item. Not a tax subsidy where the taxpayer subsidizes it, but a tax subsidy where the taxpayers are the beneficiaries of it. And on top of all of that, it is, I am absolutely certain, the only retail business operating in this state, the single retail business operating in this state today that gives the state a fair shake on the collection of the sales tax. I am certain if I described the business and didn't give it the name of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board to incoming Governor Corbett, any number of his predecessors, and without knowing who they may be, any number of his successors, and said, Governor, we have this business as I've just described it to you and your listeners. We would like to start it in Pennsylvania, and the governor's response would immediately be, well, how much, Irwin, do you need to help me get started?
You're absolutely right. But let me ask you this, because, you know, there's the cry to, and it's almost a right-leaning theology, if you will, that private industry always does things better. So I'm curious how it is that in what you've laid out, sounds like a positive business model, good for the taxpayers, good for the consumers, good for the state. Why this fascination, this desire to privatize this off and basically give it away?
Well, there are several reasons. Reason number one is it's easy to say, oh, the state shouldn't be in this business. Well, the state is in this business, but the state's in this business for a series of reasons, not the least which is what I've described, that it is a moneymaker for us. One of the two or three things that the state does that actually makes money. So it's a quick fix for those who have been irresponsible for decades and not funded properly the things that they have voted to create. Number two, remember what we're dealing with. I apologize in advance for what I'm going to say because you and I right now are members of that fourth estate, the media that does this, but newspapers look for advertising revenue and they constantly hammer away at the liquor store system and tell lies about it. So they stand to get a lot of revenue, so they try to create public opinion. Number three, you saw it yesterday and you saw it in the 6 or 8 or 10 weeks leading up to yesterday. Corporations are now unbridled in the political system, and corporations like 7-Elevens and Rite Aids and who knows what that think that they'll sell 3 or 4 different bottles of wine in their store and make a killing while having an 18-year-old kid minimum wage worker behind the counter and a manager of a store who gets an incentive for selling wine and beer and whiskey and who knows what in their so-called drug stores or convenience stores, will get a bonus here if they run the tab up, and therefore don't have a concern about who buys and don't have a concern about bottle pick and selection. Will make a lot of money, and they're a fine lobby, and so they can put a whole lot of money into the system to get their kinds of candidates elected. They're able to put a whole lot of time into the system to try to get it sold and stolen. But I view this quite simply as a business in which I am a shareholder. I'm a capitalist here. I'm no socialist. And as a capitalist, I see this wonderful business with a great business model, a wonderful, successful plan that does good and creates good jobs. And I'm ready to fight. I'm ready to fight on that one, and I'm ready to tell that story, and I'm not bashful about telling that story.
Well, it's a good story, but it's the one that we tell on every one of these privatization schemes, whether we're privatizing our parking garages or our public transportation or anything that we, the people, control, anything that's part of our commons, if you will, that when they want to shell that off for a quick buck, I don't understand why we're not screaming that we're getting the screws here.
Well, get ready, buddy, because if somebody tries to do it, we're going to be doing the screaming. Fact of the matter is that there are some things that are uniquely and appropriately publicly owned and publicly operated. Why not privatize the police force? Why not privatize the firefighters? We are not going to be capable of surviving as a society if we part ourselves out for the convenient quick fix. And that's what these hocus pocus double sham privatization schemes mean, and I know beyond fear of any contradiction that these are the kind of fights that we have faced before. I faced this liquor store fight once or twice before in my career, maybe 6 or 7 times. We have prevailed, and we're about prevailing again, not because we think that the appropriate choice here is to be backward, but it's an appropriate choice to be forward. Why in the world would we give up a successful business, particularly at a time when the economy is on its back? I read the tea leaves from yesterday, and I read the reports and listened to the talking heads all day today. I'm ready, and I urge all your listeners who are ready to deal with these issues, to stand up and fight. And I urge John Boehner, and I urge Governor-elect Corbett, and any number of other public officials who are in office or want to be in office, show me the jobs. I'm ready to go to work. My friends who are out of work are ready to go to work.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, since these things are supposed to have happened so quickly, I want to know what job John Boehner is going to provide to my unemployed neighbor tomorrow.
Absolutely, and this is what I've been saying from the beginning. Right now, all of that stuff that they complained about, all of it is off the table. Now the $1 trillion that corporate America is sitting on, that we've given them, they should be spending, hiring people, putting people back to work.
Well, you know, I don't recall anybody asking for a publicly funded bailout of the state liquor store system The liquor store system in Pennsylvania is bailing everybody else out. The liquor store system, the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, didn't get a TARP, didn't get a stimulus. It didn't get anything except for the opportunity to provide family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining benefits in virtually every community in this state and to assure that in places like Hunker, Pennsylvania in Westmoreland County and in Kerwinsville in Clearfield County and here in Harrisburg where I'm sitting and in Dunmore and in Cole Township, people have the same selection and the same access and the same control that they have in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh.
Sounds like a win-win to me. You bring up family-sustaining wages, and the last thing I wanted to get to here is a friend of mine, and I shouldn't say a friend, an acquaintance, said that now that the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion, kiss Davis prevailing wage goodbye, and he's hoping that Pennsylvania will be the next right-to-work state. Are those fights that we're going to be fighting in the coming months?
I wouldn't be surprised if we have to fight those fights. We fought them before. We'll fight them again. We'll win because, as I said when we got started, this isn't about Democrats or Republicans. This is about what's good for Pennsylvania. Prevailing wage, whether it's the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act for state and local jobs or the Davis-Bacon Act for federal jobs, isn't just some kind of grab. This is a statutory framework conceived in both instances, not by Democrats, but by Republicans. In the 1930s for the Davis-Bacon Act, Davis and Bacon were Republican senator and House member, respectively, or the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act, which was adopted in 1961 here in Pennsylvania during the time of Republican-controlled House, Senate, and governorship. These are minimum wage laws. They're laws aimed at protecting our communities, at not using taxpayer money to engage, if you will, in a race to the bottom by having our community standards eroded with the use of tax dollars. This isn't about how do we get the union wage. This is the prevailing wage, the most frequently paid wage to skilled tradesmen and craftsmen in carpentry work, in plumbing work, in HVAC, heating, ventilating, and air conditioning work, in electrical work, in tile setting, in painting, in paper hang, roofing, in all of the basic crafts and trades that are involved. And I don't have any interest as a citizen of this state and in this country in having my children go to a school that was built not by people who have the skills to do those things, but by whoever we could get to wander onto the job most cheaply. And, oh, by the way, when people attempt to slash the prevailing wage rate, it doesn't get passed through the taxpayers who are footing the bill. It gets passed through to the contractors who are still charging the same prices, as our research has indicated, but putting the money in their pockets instead of in the pockets of the skilled workers who are doing the job.
Yep. And in every place that I've read where they've gone back and they've done away with the prevailing wage, you've lost your local construction base. You end up with transients coming through to do your building projects.
Well, you know, I don't know if the listeners know this, but one of the hallmarks in the building and construction trades that are unionized in Pennsylvania and across the United States is workers contribute several cents, sometimes dollars, an hour for every hour that they work for the sole and exclusive purpose of providing totally privately funded, worker funded training programs. We call them apprenticeship programs. And they assure quality entry into the craft or trade of people who then get 4 or 5 years of training. People who I match up with any degree granting institution and degree granting program in the country. So that at the other end of this, we have a continuous cycle of highly skilled, highly trained, highly motivated people who have learned their trades and crafts, not at the cost of one penny to the public. And when you slash prevailing wage rates, one of the first things to go are these model training programs, training facilities in every corner of Pennsylvania, for example, that would be impacted and would be affected. And How is that good? How does that advance the ball when the next local firehouse is built by people who didn't get the right kind of training, didn't get the right kind of background, didn't get the right kind of supervision in learning their crafts?
Well, I can think of one thing that would be, one group that would be happy, the people who make for-profit schools.
Well, once again, for-profit schools are an intriguing model. Why would we want to have a for-profit institution that is delivering the skills to read and write and add and subtract to our children so that we assure that only the people who can pay the for-profit school get access to the quality education and everybody else is left behind? This is a country and a state that has been built on a fundamental principle that as we advance, we reach our hands back to those behind us and help to pull them along.
At least I hope that to be the case.
Well, if we abandon that principle, God help us, because in the end, that is the beginning of turning Pennsylvania or the United States into the Roman Empire.
That's sometimes you wonder, and that's a good place to leave this, Irwin. I appreciate your time. Great information. And look, as I'm telling people, now is the time to come together and start for 2012. Start organizing for the fights that are coming up. Because as we've talked about here, the prevailing wage, I think, is that's going to be a fight that's going to be had. The liquor stores, another fight that is going to be had very soon. And we've got to be ready for that. Irwin, again, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great night.
You too. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
There's one especially ugly word that an author never wants to hear. Pulp. To pulp a book is not merely to remove it from sale, but literally to destroy it, reducing the paper itself and all of your words and thoughts to a goopy chemical mash. I've had one of my books threatened with pulping even before it went on sale, so I can empathize with Anthony Schaefer, who has just had the first printing of his book gooped by a gang of goofy censors in the Pentagon. Schaefer, a lieutenant colonel who served as an Army intelligence officer in Afghanistan, had written Operation Dark Heart, an unflattering assessment of American military intelligence bureaucracy. Playing by the rules, Colonel Schaefer had dutifully submitted his manuscript to the Army prior to publication, getting its official approval in January to publish. So, 10,000 copies were printed and placed in a distribution warehouse, about 100 advance copies were sent to book reviewers, and Schaefer even received the endorsement of a former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency who hailed the memoir as, quote, one terrific book. But in July, the goofiness hit the fan. Someone in DIA began objecting to Schaefer's critique, and suddenly some 250 passages were deemed to contain military secrets. These so-called secrets were mostly well-known facts already published in news articles, Wikipedia, and elsewhere. But Schaefer's permission to publish was abruptly retracted. The Pentagon brass then bought the 10,000 warehouse copies and, in the overbearing name of national security, had them pulped. This is Jim Hightower saying, the pulping merely proves Schaefer's point about the heavy-handed stupidity of the military intelligence establishment, while also showing, once again, that the Pentagon brass has way too many of our tax dollars to play with.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
If they get the chance, you can kiss it goodbye. And I'm telling you, we lose the state stores. You see Harrisburg sell off their garages like Pittsburgh's doing. That, folks, is a theft of our infrastructure. It is a theft of like Irwin was talking about. You know, these things pay dividends every year. They pay into the state treasuries. Why? So we don't have to. Amazing, amazing stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Our quote comes from The Pledge, page 15 of The Pledge. And we're going to be talking an awful lot about the Grand Pledge because we're going to hold them to it. I've got it in my hand without the pictures. I didn't need the 27 pages of smiling white people in the pictures. I did download the 21 pages of writing, though. Most of it worthless, but there are some things. Here's the quote from page 15. The American people know that to boost the economy, spending must be slashed. Tax increases must be prevented. And small business must have certainty that rules won't change every few months so they can get back on their feet. The consistent threat of new taxes and new regulations prevents investors and entrepreneurs from putting capital at risk. These private sector employers must be given the certainty that if they take a risk to expand their business and hire a new employee, Washington won't yank the rug out from under their feet. Nice, good, solid, jingoistic speak. I love it. Yes. Keep, yes, yes. Problem is, most of it's wrong, wrong, wrong. But they're going to have a chance. And they now have the majority in the House. And they're going to have a chance. So I'm saying right now, the business community understands there's no more regulation. There are no more taxes. Not happening. Business community, they're fine. So the $1 trillion that they're sitting on, all this money that they're sitting on, they should be putting back into the economy. Look, corporate America got what they wanted. They got a very friendly, business-friendly Republican Party, very thrilled at the fact that they now control the House of Representatives. So all that stuff stopped. All that stuff has stopped. So the jobs should come flowing through. Like I said last night, like bare-breasted virgins with a stream of honey flowing over their bosoms. We should be living in Mecca, if you will, because the jobs will be here. That's what they told us during the election. They told us all we have to do is stop them, and the jobs will come back. And their plan, going to the pledge, the Grand Pledge right here, great jobs, the Grand Pledge. You know what the Grand Pledge is? The Grand Pledge is a bunch of, I hate Obama, I hate Obama, I hate Obama, I hate Obama. Oh, hey, we're going to give 20% tax breaks to small businesses. We're going to deregulate. We're going to give the wealthy more permanent tax cuts so we can extend those Bush handouts. That's their plan. This is it. Didn't we try this? But we're going to try it again because, like Winston Churchill said, Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. So I guess we're doing everything else first. Amazing stuff. Our caller hung up. What's that? Oh, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. At the end of this, in the Grand Pledge, Jake, and hey, welcome back. In the Grand Pledge, the things that they do talk about, child tax credits. Part of me is in favor because I got three kids. So it'd be nice to have those three tax credits. Personally, I don't think we should be rewarding people straight across the board for producing more offspring. I do believe that if people at the bottom of the economic scale need the help, we, by all means, give it to them. But I'm sorry, Bill Gates having a couple of kids, which, you know, he's got enough. He doesn't need an extra $1,000. So, again, it's one of these things that I think should be targeted. Not just, here, everybody, have more kids. It's not like we don't have enough people in this country. I don't know if you've been on the road lately, Jake, but the highways are packed full of people.
You mean like 81 every night? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Like the traffic jams I ran into coming to Harrisburg tonight?
Like every night. But at the end of this, the grand plan to create jobs is nothing but more tax cuts, more deregulation, and less oversight and less regulations. And I ask you, you know, the Bush years were full of this stuff. We really gave out $1.7 trillion, was it, in handouts in the hopes that more jobs would be created. Didn't happen. But we keep telling ourselves, if we keep doing this, if we keep doing it, eventually rich people have got to have enough money. Eventually the billionaire class has got to have enough that it spills out of their pocket. And when it spills out of their pocket, we'll be there with our hungry children to grab that money. I mean, that seems to be what we think, that this trickle-down thing is going to work. If we give business and we give the wealthy everything they could possibly want, they will feel sorry for us at some level and trickle and rain down on the rest of us. It hasn't worked, though. What we've done is we've created a billionaire class. The Forbes 400 is a billionaire class that we haven't had from the end of World War II. Because during that period after World War II, we had the Great Compression. We had wages that became more equal. We grew a middle class at the expense of the poverty, at the expense of the wealth class. And yeah, I'm talking about redistribution of wealth. And we need to talk about this. We need to talk about the economic pie being divided in a way that sustains an economy, not just says, oh, hey, by the way, you at the very top, you can have everything. The rest of us, you can get by on nothing. The other thing the Republicans talk about is they want to do away with the marriage penalty. And I'm against that. You know, I'm against, you know, doing away with what's happened. I mean, this is something I do agree with the Republicans on. This marriage penalty is kind of silly. They're two people. They should both be able to declare their personhood, if you will.
I agree with that, Rick. In fact, you have some people who I've never understood this. They remain, they'll either remain single or get married, depending on their circumstance, just to avoid taxes, which is silly. Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, it's one of those things that just kind of weird. But again, the tax plan here that the Republicans are telling us, it's light on anything actually concrete. It's more of the same. It's got some nice language. The guy who wrote it, the lobbyist who wrote it, did a fantastic job. Lots of very, very American language. Lots of very powerful language. But again, no substance. And I'm saying right now, if the jobs don't come, you should expect to call this experiment a failure. And what frightens me is that we're going to begin this ping-ponging back and forth. That, oh, well, the Democrats, they didn't do everything we wanted them to do, so the progressives stayed home. And now you're going to swing to the other side where the Tea Twizzlers in about 6 months are going to be completely disenfranchised because they're not going to get what they want. Look, the government is not going to come to a screeching halt. We are not going to be selling off the White House. Not going to happen. But that's what they want. So amazingly enough, we've got some opportunity to have great discussions, spirited discussions on the direction of the country, and I think it starts right now. Let's take a quick break. We're right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or you can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this.
If your loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. The Blue Dogs were some of the bigger losers. 22 of the 46 Blue Dogs were shown the door. And, you know, to be honest, a lot of them came from fairly conservative districts to begin with. I look at Kathy Delkemper, who, to be honest, she was out of place to begin with in that district. So, you know, you can see how, even in a reasonable year, she could have lost. But, man, what a thumping the Democrats took yesterday. And look, I got to be honest with you. I don't think this is a repudiation of what the Democrats did. I think it's a repudiation. It's what they didn't do. They didn't go far enough. They didn't make people's lives better right now. The one thing that you can say about Bush, when he decided he was going to hand out money, he made sure you knew he gave you money. He made sure of it. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, pretty good. Hey, Rick. Listening to some of the dialogue just before, something is very different this time that I don't know that the Republicans understand, and that is the dynamics of the time. They don't have the luxury of time anymore.
Nope.
They don't have 6 months or a year to put their plans together, staff their organizations, hold some parties, hold some meetings, because it'll all be over. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania will be broke, effectively, when the new governor comes in. He said no more taxes. He has nothing to do. So probably the governor's first job when he comes in is to figure out how many people he's going to lay off and where. And he has to do it really quick. He doesn't have time.
No, I absolutely agree. And what I've been saying is I think that all of these teabaggers who did such a great job of raising money and all of these right-wing Republicans who did such a great job of taking the Chamber of Commerce's money from foreign corporations and all of this money that they were able to raise, maybe they should just keep doing that and, help fund our government?
It's an idea. But I'm afraid that what we're going to end up with in this country is the way third world countries function.
Yep.
There will be a fairly nice living for very wealthy people who afford the school, and they'll get quality houses built because they can afford the best contractors. But the rest of society will start to survive. There'll be bribery. I mean, you take a look at Haiti, the earthquake that hit Haiti.
Yep.
What killed so many people in Haiti was the construction. And that basically ignored all the construction codes because of the draft and the nature of that government. And that's where we're headed.
And one of the guys I met who I think he said he was from Latin America, and I think he was probably from Venezuela. What he said is in his country, the people there are afraid that we here are going to turn into a Latin American country who have these wild swings from extremes, where on one side you've got, you know, Obama took over, a lot of Democrats took over with the mandate that we need health care, we need these other things, and now you got that blowback to the umpteenth extreme to undo all that. And what he said is, you know, when you start doing that, you have a destable government. That's when the shenanigans really, really starts.
And the frightening part of that is that nobody's ever seen how that works out with a superpower. When a superpower with a nuclear arsenal starts to go unstable. And it could happen. Also, it could cause balkanization of the country. There may be sections that will decide, no, I'm not going to participate anymore.
Well, I've always said this country is six nations, somehow held together by a constitution. I think there are six very distinct regions in this country that could easily, as you've said, could easily split apart.
And I think that's what's at stake here. And I don't know if people realize it or not. This is not going to be business as usual because there just simply is not time for business as usual.
I agree with you, Mike. I appreciate the call. It's I think you're spot on. Thanks so much.
All right. See you, Rick.
This is one of those things where you go, and he's spot on. There isn't time for the Republicans to play their games. There isn't time for them to say, oh, hey, we're just going to stall, delay, investigate, which is their game plan. And then they're going to turn around and say, well, the Senate wouldn't let us do it, and the President wouldn't let us do it.
Well, Mike directly was talking about the state, and to a large degree, he's probably right. But if you look at the dynamics from a political science standpoint, I find it fascinating because you're really going to have, if possible, you're going to have a more polarized Congress because, as you said, moderate Democrats got caught in that tsunami. Why? Because they were from swing districts. And some of them really didn't fit, like Dow Camper, who just happened to get elected and had good people working for her. But she lost, as did a bunch of them. So what do you have in the Democrat side? You have the liberals and the progressives for the most part, and now you have the Tea Party-backed candidates coming in the Republican Party. And it'll be interesting to see. Part of me says, hey, let the nation see what kind of craziness you're in for if you let these people take control. Here's the question. If the Republicans really want to prove to the country that they can lead, that they can govern, can they really allow these Tea Party candidates who they embraced to then become the norm? I'm not so sure they can. And is there going to be a civil war within the Republican Party? There very well might be.
I'm sure hoping.
We all are. It'll be an interesting dynamic.
And it'll be televised. It'll be right there on C-SPAN for us to see. So I'm thrilled about that because, look, they haven't had a wing of the Republican Party, really, that they could not control. This can go one of two ways. The Tea Party goes, okay, we're here, show us where the bathrooms are, show us what to do, and they fall into line. Or the other part of this is they just go and take a leak on the desk and, do whatever it is they do and do not become part of the party.
If you listen to them, they're already saying no, no, no.
Well, that's what they're saying. Once you get there and once you start having constituents calling you saying, hey, my sewer down the road is plugged up and everybody on the neighborhood's toilets won't flush, you're going to see somebody go, well, we better call somebody. Well, you privatized all that. Oh, and we don't have the money to hire somebody to go out and do it. See, it's a whole different ballgame when you're running for something and you're attacking somebody. It's easy to tear somebody down, but when it's you, when you're the guy who is the bottom of the barrel, where the buck stops, we will then see how they work. We'll see how they operate.
I saw a show last week, and it was on MSNBC, and the MC had six leaders of independent tea parties. And he said to them, okay, do you believe Social Security is a socialist system? They all said yes. Okay, tell me specifically which programs you want to eliminate that are more socialistic than Social Security. Well, one guy did say, I want to eliminate part of education, part of energy. I want means testing for Social Security, blah, blah. He went through a whole list. Now, can he do that?
No.
I doubt that. It sounds good. I want to eliminate this, this, and this. Well, is that not only pragmatic, it's doable.
Nope. We're taking a quick break. We're right back with Heather Kronk, Managing Director of Get Equal. Stick around.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham. SEIU Vice President Mitch Ackerman says the defeat of so many labor-backed U.S. House candidates was not a reflection of the true will of the majority of American voters, but the result of a concentrated corporate-funded campaign that capitalized on continuing economic pain.
This is the result of an unprecedented amount of unregulated, unreported corporate cash in these elections. This is not some sort of groundswell of enthusiasm for Tea Party and right-wing candidates.
Ackerman says despite the losses in the U.S. House, workers and their unions will continue to fight for what all workers want.
People voted for change 2 years ago pretty overwhelmingly, and it's not like the ideology of American voters switched 180 degrees in 2 years. It's that people are still hurting, and, you know, they're going to keep seeking ways to get some relief to the pain, and we're going to be out there trying to hold politicians accountable to creating good jobs in our community, to putting people back to work in the kinds of jobs that can support a family and help people send their kids to college and help us retire with dignity. And that's what working people want.
Ackerman says SEIU's national political effort scored some success in turning out the vote.
Places like Colorado, and we're celebrating the victory of John Hickenlooper for the governor's race. We did it in Nevada. Where, of course, the race was just called for Harry Reid. We did it in California. We did it in Arizona.
The National Labor Relations Board believes the Regis hair salon chain violated federal labor laws over potential anti-union activities. Jesse Russell reports.
The company's CEO, Paul Finkelstein, produced a DVD for employees in which he threatened the closure of salons if employees voted in favor of union representation. And he even went as far as telling workers they would be blacklisted in the salon industry. Posters were placed at salons encouraging employees to call a hotline if co-workers observed union activities, and the company even asked employees to sign pledges to not sign union cards. Regis has 12,700 salons around the world, making it the largest. Storefronts include Cost Cutters, Master Cuts, and a number of beauty schools.
Now that the state of New Jersey has rejected the ARC tunnel and the federal government has $3.3 billion to invest somewhere else, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is trying to arrange for all to end up in New York State. In a letter to Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, Gillibrand asks for the money to be invested into the 2nd Avenue subway project in Manhattan. Part of that project will require the MTA to invest in upgrading the infrastructure of 51 buildings along the subway's line. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again.
Well, it seems we're going back to the good old days. You know, we don't need schools. Build more prisons. We need to create jobs. More tax cuts. We need to save the economy. More privatization. Yeah, that has done so well for us the last 30 years. And what I've been saying since yesterday is, look, the Democrats took it on the chin because they didn't do enough. They didn't make people's lives better right away. We live in a McDonald's world, if you will. Everything's got to be in a nice little bag, neatly wrapped, handed to us on a silver platter as we drive by. We don't even have to get out of the car. And we didn't do that. And the president didn't do enough to communicate what he was doing. Look, you got people who got tax cuts, didn't even know it. Half the people I knew said, well, I didn't know I got a tax cut. Really? You didn't notice that? You didn't look at your check every week and go, gee, there looks like there's more. Sad, sad stuff. So the question is, where do we go from here? And I got this press release today that says a broad coalition of progressive leaders and activists are calling on the Democratic Party to act more boldly on core progressive ideas and believe that yesterday's Democratic electoral losses are largely due to elected leaders not fighting hard enough for popular progressive change, leaving voters, particularly people like me, folks who wanted to see more, wanted more leadership, left us pretty much behind, disappointed and delusioned, they write. Heather Kronk is the managing director for Get Equal. GetEqual.org is the website. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
You know, I'm looking at what happened yesterday, and it was a bloodbath. No questions. They, as the president said, they got shellacked. And I've said it's because they didn't do enough. I'm curious where you're at.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, whether it's economic issues, whether it's social issues, you know, across the board, there were a lot of promises made and a lot of rhetoric used in the 08 campaign that a lot of folks bought into. In fact, millions of people bought into. And what we were, I think, all waiting for wasn't a knight to come riding in and to save the country, but for someone to stand up for what they believed in rather than engaging in the kind of typical transactional politics that we see in D.C. And what has been really disappointing is that the Obama administration turned into that transactional political machine rather than really giving folks something aspirational that they could believe in.
Yeah, let me ask you, how much of that do you think is what really happened, or do you think that we were led to believe by the mainstream media that this guy was the second coming and that everything would be fixed when this mythical character that they created finally had the reins and the power of the pen?
I mean, I think that to some degree that's certainly, you could chalk that up to the media. You know, the media industrial complex that exists in D.C. is certainly not used to having someone with a community organizer background vying for the White House. Right. So I think that there was some element of painting this messianic character as the one who was running rather than, the left centrist. That I think Obama really is. But then when he started surrounding himself with folks who are nowhere close to being progressive, much less bold leaders, I think that really manifested in some pretty disappointing ways.
Oh, I absolutely agree. When he announced Rahm Emanuel was going to be his chief of staff, I almost did a backflip.
Yeah, that was really the first big disappointment in my mind. And really, I think, set the tone for what an Obama administration was going to look like in ways that were much different from an Obama campaign.
Well, and going back to that and looking at what they did to him in 08 and 09, making him out to be this grand character, this savior, if you will, the second coming. If you're noticing the papers now, they are really trying to play down the Republicans. The Republicans are out there saying, well, you know, this wasn't a mandate. You know, we got a lot of work to do. We're not going to say, so we'll get the things in time. Because I'm saying right now, H.R. 1 should be repeal health care immediately. That's what they ran on.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we'll see the extent to which Republicans and especially Tea Party Republicans were engaging in that same, transformational versus transactional politics. I have a sense that there are going to be some rude awakenings when folks like Rand Paul get to D.C. and things operate a little bit differently here. But that's not to say that they can't do it. I mean, really, like, the Tea Party has an example that they should learn from. And by all means, I'm not excited about there being a Tea Party caucus going on within the halls of Congress. But if they've learned a lesson, then they'll figure out pretty quickly to stick to their guns, which, you know, bode well for those of us who are progressive.
Yeah, I agree. But here's the thing. I really like Michelle Bachmann. I mean, but then again, I've always been attracted to crazy. And and I'm just really attracted to her on a really, really, it's one of those things. And I got to be honest, I like the fact that there's a Tea Party caucus that she's in charge of. Even if it is crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say if I would use the word like. I mean, I think that
infatuated with. How's that?
Yeah. Well, no, I would say that I'm a little infatuated with it as well, and I'm certainly curious about what's going to happen once we get into January and see how folks who identify so closely and carefully with the Tea Party enjoy governing. It's a lot easier to sit on the sidelines and tell folks how it should be.
Yep.
But we'll see what happens. And I think that the Republican leadership has learned a lesson, at least in, you know, these first couple of hours after returns have come in, that they're not getting arrogant, at least publicly. sure there's some partying going on within the halls, but you know, I think they've learned their lesson that they need to at least publicly show that they're going to kind of you know, slink in, because they certainly don't have any more favorable ratings than Democrats and the Obama administration does.
Well, what was amazing to me, you saw some of the polls where people were walking out of the polling places with less favorability for Republicans that they just voted for. Rasmussen just came out with a poll and said, you know, 59% of the people think they're going to be just as disappointed in 2 years as they are right now.
Yeah, and really, I mean, I don't think that anyone would expect anything different. I don't think that the Republicans were selling something that was monumentally more inspiring or more meaningful for people's lives, certainly not for working people's lives, than Democrats were. But I think that they were certainly more convincing of the rhetoric behind that, even if they didn't have the policy to back it up.
Were they selling something? I thought it was just the same old crap they've been selling for 30 years.
Well, it was the same old crap with a little bit of a different binder that it was wrapped up in.
Yeah, I mean,
but it was certainly, you know, politics of fear, which, you know, that certainly motivates people when there's an economy crashing down around you.
Yeah, like I said, the pledge, the grand pledge, which I'm holding in my hand, is 48 pages, 20, like any good conservative book, 27 of those 48 pages, pictures. And a couple of the other pictures had the pages that had writing on it. Most of them had graphs. So it was only really a half a page of writing on most of the pages.
Yeah, so, and really mostly ignoring social issues, which I thought was really was pretty interesting to see come out of the Republican Party that has traded on fear around social issues, especially around Get Equal Does LGBT organizing, you know, especially around LGBT issues. So it was interesting to see how they had decided to package the same policies and same ideas that they've been selling for the past couple of decades.
Yeah. Let me ask you then, what exactly does Get Equal do? What do you guys work on?
Yeah, we work on LGBT issues. Of course, those intersect with a lot of other issues at the same time. But our place within the movement and our place within the political sphere is to employ both online organizing techniques, but also direct action, such as protests and sit-ins and those sorts of tactics in order to really kind of shine a light on discrimination within the LGBT, involving LGBT Americans.
Right. And what exactly is LGBT?
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender.
Okay. For those who don't know.
Yeah.
Because I got to be honest, you know, I'm looking at a couple of reports. You guys did some good work on getting people elected.
Yeah, well, we we did some good work on getting people elected and not getting people elected. And Get Equal has really, we've been around for 7 months, so we're, you know, relatively new on the scene. But we've also been, you know, pushing back on Democrats a good bit, saying, look, there are a whole lot of things that you've promised to Americans, including LGBT Americans, and you're not making good on any of those promises. So at some point, we have to stand up for ourselves and say, look, you know, it's a lot easier. You're showing a lot more courage when you're cashing our checks than when you're casting votes.
Yep.
And at some point, you have to decide whether you're going to have a backbone or not.
And, you know, I've always said, and, you know, to be honest, it's not my issue, but, you know, I've always said it should be a conservative issue.
I really think it should be. In fact, I did a radio interview this morning with a pretty conservative, actually a pretty libertarian radio show out of Cincinnati. And on 95% of issues, we agreed. And it was actually really surprising because I kept saying, yeah, I actually think that we're saying the exact same thing here. When you have 75% of Americans saying that they think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be repealed, this is not even an issue that you have to show courage on. We're not asking for anything that's radical or, you know, that's outside of significant polling. We're just asking for something that a vast majority of Americans already agree with. And we still can't get leadership within Congress to make that happen.
And to me, it's you know, I don't care what people do within the confines of their four walls. That's their business. And, you know, as my grandfather always said, look, you have the right to do whatever you want as long as your rights don't infringe upon mine and
yep.
vice versa.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And again, I think this is a conservative frame, personal responsibility, individual rights, you know, but I can't get my conservative friends to come along.
Yeah, and what's interesting is kind of looking at the generational shift that's happening right now, because, you know, we were talking earlier about, or I mentioned the lack of social issues in the new Republican handbook. And it's not that they don't believe in, you know, in retaining, you know, codified discrimination through Don't Ask, Don't Tell, through the Defense of Marriage Act, and things like that. But they know that it's a losing issue. They know that there's a generation coming up for whom this is really a non-starter, not an issue at all. Can't believe that we're still talking about it.
Like me.
Sorry?
Like me. I mean, that's my...
Exactly.
It's not my issue, but look, you know, I don't want to discriminate against anybody. You do what you do what it is that makes you happy. That's the end of it.
And that's what we're seeing from folks like Senator McCain, who have said, come hell or high water, I will filibuster the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And really, you know, it's getting to a point where he just kind of looks like a bitter old man who's clinging to inequality. And it's really kind of a shame to watch.
Did he look like anything else?
Not that I've seen.
Well, okay. That's, you know, that's a good answer. I got Heather Kronk, managing director of GetEqual. GetEqual.org is the website. We'll put a link on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com so you can take a look at what they've got over there. Last question I've got for you, Heather. Where do we move forward from here with the progressive groups? I've been calling for constant organizing. One of the things that we in labor do, where, you know, we ramp up a couple of months before an election, and then after the election, it kind of goes away. I'm saying it's got to be year-round consistent, and we need to grow our organization and fund it more than anything and get people out, boots out on the street, and keep the fight going, because it's going to be, I think it's going to be brutal these next 2 years.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we have people emailing us every day, especially over the last couple of days, saying, you know what, I am just fed up with the way that things operate right now. Tell me when to go out into the streets and I'll be there. So we are trying to figure out, you know, what's most strategic and what's the best use of resources, you know, in an environment where resources are always strapped and we're always David fighting against Goliath. But I absolutely think that this is, you know, the prime time to redirect the narrative and really show both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that there's a really, really strong populist progressive movement out there that's just waiting to sink our teeth into our U.S. government.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Heather. Heather Kronk, managing director of GetEqual. Again, GetEqual.org. Heather, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
There's one especially ugly word that an author never wants to hear. Pulp. To pulp a book is not merely to remove it from sale, but literally to destroy it, reducing the paper itself and all of your words and thoughts to a goopy chemical mash. I've had one of my books threatened with pulping even before it went on sale, so I can empathize with Anthony Schaefer, who has just had the first printing of his book gooped by a gang of goofy censors in the Pentagon. Schaefer, a lieutenant colonel who served as an Army intelligence officer in Afghanistan, had written Operation Dark Heart, an unflattering assessment of America's military intelligence bureaucracy. Playing by the rules, Colonel Schaefer had dutifully submitted his manuscript to the Army prior to publication, getting its official approval in January to publish. So, 10,000 copies were printed and placed in a distribution warehouse, about 100 advance copies were sent to book reviewers, and Schaefer even received the endorsement of a former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency who hailed the memoir as, quote, one terrific book. But in July, the goofiness hit the fan. Someone in DIA began objecting to Schaefer's critique, and suddenly some 250 passages were deemed to contain military secrets. These so-called secrets were mostly well-known facts already published in news articles, Wikipedia, and elsewhere. But Schaefer's permission to publish was abruptly retracted. The Pentagon brass then bought the 10,000 warehouse copies and, in the overbearing name of national security, had them pulped. This is Jim Hightower saying, the pulping merely proves Schaefer's point about the heavy-handed stupidity of the military intelligence establishment, while also showing, once again, that the Pentagon brass has way too many of our tax dollars to play with. Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Not right now. This is when we start. We start the organization right now. We start the fight right now. I got an email from Scott in Stockholm. Yes, Stockholm. That's not. I don't think there's a Stockholm in Pennsylvania. So I'm assuming this is Sweden. He writes, I want to add my voice to those saying the time has come to organize. The bosses never rest in trying to lower wages, either directly or some nickel and dime BS having the same effect, cutting social programs, removing health care and other benefits, and so on. He says, here in Sweden, we workers are much better organized than you Americans, and our vigilance has so far paid off. But there's never a day off. You have to be represented at every level of government and in companies. The sad thing is, there are no knights, no cavalry. It's not going to be a dash. You don't go in and fix it while you sit on your sofa after a hard day's work. Workers have to take it home with them. Workers have to take it one to another, 9 to 5, and go from there. Because if we don't, we lose. It's always a fight. The fight is just one part of daily life. Get used to it and fight hard. Because if the bosses keep winning, we end up as Bangladeshis. And Scott couldn't be more right. And this is what I have been saying all along. And it comes down to going back and doing what organized labor used to do. Organizing people. Getting them out. Fighting. Making people aware of what's going on.
Well, too often when we go to battle and sometimes we win, we think like, we finally...
Put that to rest.
We reached nirvana, and boy, we're at the mountaintop, and now we can relax a little bit. Well, the struggle never ends. The struggle never ends, and the gentleman from Sweden is exactly right. Every day you take off, your enemy is gaining on you. Absolutely correct.
And that's where, you know, a lot of the European countries have got us. Because we don't have that class solidarity. We don't look to our neighbor and say, if he fails, I'm going to go with him. We don't do that. I know a lot of people who say, if he fails, oh boy, much better for me. And then the reality is it's not that way. We all sink together. And it's not the individual. This election to me has been that time where all we're concerned about is me here and now. It's all about me. It's all about the individual. And what I was saying yesterday is that what we're living off of right now, the infrastructure, the schools, the roads, the bridges, the hospitals, all of this stuff that is here right now took a generation or two ago to have the vision, foresight, and the sacrifice to put in front of us so that we would have the opportunity to be a great nation. What are we leaving down the road? What are we leaving our children? And I was listening to a church radio program this past weekend, and the pastor was saying they were buying some doily or something, and a salesperson came in and marveled at the ornate church and the stained glass windows and all of the stuff that you
that you would think of from your generation of going to church. He's going, the salesman said, you know, so many of the churches I see now are basically places that, used to be supermarkets or used to be a Pizza Hut. Now it's a church. And that's, and I, that really caught me because is that what we're leaving for our children? Is that the legacy that we're leaving 20 years, 50 years down the road?
Well, you know, the gentleman from Sweden, or if you go into most of the industrialized, I would say blanket statement, all the industrialized countries in Europe. I mean, there was no time off. Their struggle has been going on decade after decade after decade. Whereas here, I mean, we made some dramatic dramatic leaps, 30s, 40s, 50s. Those were just, you know, quantum leaps for working people. And we might be a generation or two attached from that. We don't really know what it is to fight the struggle on a daily basis. We think every now and then if we put in a couple R's and an election, making calls or knocking on doors every 2 years, that's all that requires. And we forget that it is a daily struggle. It's hard work. But the alternative is your enemies win. The alternative is a lesser a quality of life for you and your family.
Because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, or I'm sorry, the International Chamber of Commerce, they don't run out of time or money. They're constantly out there funding tanks and talking heads and programs like Beck and Limbaugh and Hannity and all of those high-priced mouthpieces. The flow of money, the river of gold does not end.
It'll be interesting, Rick, to find out when the reports come out how much money was funded in, not only from the chamber, but indirectly from foreign countries, companies in foreign countries into the Toomey campaign. I was telling my friend here,
down the stretch,
there was a Toomey commercial every 15 minutes. Huge expense, and they seemed to have unlimited number of dollars.
And it was the third-party expenditures. Almost the early numbers I've seen, $500 million.
And for Sestak,
this whole election cycle, $4 billion.
For Sestak to get that close, I think he had perhaps, well, he did. He had better infrastructure, but eventually that money's, you know, it's just too much. You know, they hate to admit it, but money bought some of these campaigns. And then on top of it, actually, you know, you talked about generics. I looked at the generic poll, even several days, recently. So it was relevant to right now. The Democrats actually, believe it or not, Rick, generic polling. All voters, Democrats had a 1 or 2 point lead. The problem was that was just all voters, and, again, the passion was on their side. And they got their people out, and we didn't get them out.
And shame on us.
That's absolutely correct.
Shame on the progressive movement. Look, you know, we just talked to Heather here a minute ago, and, you know, as a progressive group, you say, okay, well, we didn't get what we wanted, and we didn't. The president didn't do what he should have done, and that's no reason to say I'm staying home. You make your point, but not at the expense of the rest of your face. You know, and what bothers me in this whole thing is you look at the numbers, and Democrats did. They stayed home.
Well, two categories we lost that we definitely. One is just historic on the Democratic side. The other one was in huge numbers in 08, the independents for the Toomey campaign. They went with Toomey 54-46. But here's the really disappointing number. Women historically have voted Democratic. And that's actually a demographic that was getting better the last 10 years. Toomey won that by 55-45, which surprises me. Now, that surprises me.
Well, because they did a very good job of painting Toomey as a moderate, as a
family man,
sitting on the couch, reading the Bible to his child.
Isn't it special?
But, you know, hey, this is what sells. This is what politics is about. It's about creating that image of the non-extremist. And we know what he's going to do when he gets there. We know he's going to be a strong voice for Wall Street. We know he's going to be a strong voice to privatize Social Security. We know it. And let's not be surprised when it happens. So the question then becomes, where do we go from here? Does President Obama do as I suspect he's going to do, keep reaching his hand out and following the Republicans to the right? Or does he do as a lot of progressive groups are saying, stand your ground, draw a line in the sand, and say, look, we are not going past this line. We are going to fight every issue, and we're going to do what's right as opposed to what's right now, what's popular.
Well, there's another question. what will he do? Will he look at the election with kind of like a jaundiced eye and say, well, I don't know if I can do that this next 2 years if I want to get reelected, or is he going to follow his heart and go with the progressive movement? That it'll be interesting to see what he does.
He hasn't done much to follow the progressive movement to this par, to this point, but we're already seeing some giving. Talking about, well, you know, maybe we can work with getting...
I heard him talk about health care.
Well, the top,
some of the mandates.
Well, the top 2% are going to get their tax handouts. There's some talk of, you know, well, maybe we're going to soften our position.
Well, I heard a pundit talk, and he was an insider, and what he said makes sense. He said what they might do is keep the tax breaks...
Till 2012.
Keep the tax breaks permanent for the lower income. However, the top echelon, maybe allow them to have it maybe 2 years and compromise, and maybe some of the enough Republicans were willing to accept that. That's a possibility. Now, the Republicans aren't going to accept, you know, ending them. That's just not going to happen. So if they're going to be there, there's going to have to be compromise.
And we will see. I mean, it'll be interesting to see where we end up with this. Because if things go the way they look like they may be going, we will have nothing done for the next 2 years. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, you can email me, Rick. At TheRickSmithShow.com. We're right back. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are. Not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
You know what surprised me in this whole election cycle? Is that there were 40 to 50% of the people in this country who did not know that they had gotten a tax cut. That, to me, is mind-blowing. How do you not know that there's more money in your check? I mean, really. I got to be honest. For years, I worked, you know, a number of hours. I'd work 60, 70 hours a week. And I would go back through my paycheck at the beginning of the week, and I'd make sure I wrote down everything I should have been paid for. I figured out to the penny how much it should have been. And when I looked at it in my paycheck, every penny had better be there. And at the end of the week, I knew how much should be after taxes, after putting away from my 401k, after doing a whole bunch of things. I knew how much would be in my bank account to make sure I didn't get cheated. You know, when you grow up on the streets, the one thing you learn quickly, money. You learn how not to get cheated out of your money. So it's amazing to me that you've got half of the people in the country who get their paycheck and must not look at it or know how much should be there. Wouldn't you think that you would know? I mean, it went up. If you looked at your check and it went up and you didn't know why, wouldn't you think you'd question that? Or at least maybe say something? Or is that too simple? Is that too simple-minded? Or is it that we just don't understand budgeting at all? Because I got to be honest with you, you know, when I sit down at the beginning of the year and write out my personal budget, how much I expect to pay for electric, how much I expect to pay for mortgage, and right down the line, because I do. I have a budget, and I need to know every day how much I need to make and how much is going to go to what, and I know. So when I get my paycheck, and it's got a couple of extra bucks in it, I start going, well, wait a second, where'd that come from? So I don't understand how 40 to 50% of the people in this country could not know they got a tax break.
That's easy, believable. I can just relate to the work site where I work, workplace. A lot of people, they never check their trade.
Never?
No. Well, I say never. Generically, that's probably a bit off. But for the most part, no. They just accepted it. If it was in the ballpark, they could have been paid too much, and they could have been paid a couple bucks less. Now, think about it. What if every employee where I work, several thousand, was paid $1 less than they deserved?
Yeah.
That employer over time, you know, saved an awful lot of money. I'm not saying they did that, but, I mean, you know what I know. You probably saw the numbers. There's an awful lot of cheating going on in the workplace by employers.
And you can give them the benefit of the doubt, because I honestly don't believe that employers want to cheat you. Some things just happen. I'm giving the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes it happens. But I know myself, I've caught numerous times over the years where I've been a little light. And I've had to say, I'm a little light. Please make that whole. I've yet to find where I've been heavy and had to give anything back. The mistakes never happened in my favor.
Are you deferring that you never caught they were a little heavy? Or you?
I don't honestly remember ever finding a check that was a little bit heavy.
Okay.
I found a lot that were a little light.
Is that your story and you're sticking to it?
Well, that's my story. It's not a story. That's I'm sticking to what I said. Like okay. I do with everything. If I say it, if it comes out of these lips, it's gospel.
Okay.
You better believe it. But, you know, the thing is this is a failure of our education system? Is this a failure of how we are as consumers, as citizens, that we're this complacent that we couldn't know that? Well, I guess my question pretty much answers itself when you look at how many people are in really big financial trouble, that they don't budget,
But doesn't that involve a little bit more than just budgeting? A lot of times it's just stupid investments, overextension of credit. I mean, it goes beyond just
not
budgeting.
Not knowing how much is in your check.
That.
But here's the thing, and this is where the failure happened. George Bush, when he gave out money, when he gave us that little pittance of $300, and I think there was another time he gave us $500. Here, go. Here's a check. Go be irresponsible. You knew where you got it from. And politically, it was a winner. Now, governing-wise, it was an abject failure because it cost us millions of dollars to do it that way. And extra man hours to write the checks and mail them and postage. And, you know, hey, the post office needed the business, so good. But from a governing standpoint, from an efficiency standpoint, it was the most inefficient method of getting money into the hands of people. The most efficient method, just change the tax rate in your checks so that you're getting more. But what this is telling me is that Americans are dimwits and they don't check their own checks.
Unfortunately, that's true of a lot of people. Absolutely. And that's my experience.
So we seem to prefer bloated, wasteful, inefficient government so that we're smacked awake by, we got this check. Oh, look, I got a check. Oh, boy. I got a check. My government loves me. They gave me money.
And I can go to the track. Which some people did, let's be honest.
I hope they did. That was
As long as the wife doesn't know
anything. I hope that's what happened, because that's at least some consumption. What I did with mine, I end up finding out, my wife told me that I paid electric bill with it. It basically just went into the general account and paid bills like the rest of my money. But, you know, here's the thing. We were told that this was going to spur the economy. These tax cuts were going to spur the economy. And the reality is we just used it to make ends meet. We learned it in the 70s when Ford tried it, and it didn't work. So we've been trying these Republican schemes from the mid-70s, and they still haven't worked. And we're talking about it again. I guess we got to relearn this because it's not going to work this time.
How many times do you hear people when we talk about stimulating the economy, maybe creating, you know, creating a little wealth? How many people have you talked to and said, well, you know, if we're going to give all this stimulus money, why don't we give each person $1 million?
Oh, yeah.
How many times have you heard
that's
that?
That's a great one. And it shows how bad it is.
You know,
I'd
like to keep a diary on that. I know some people I would bet that $1 million within about 2 years is gone.
The million dollars would be gone almost immediately, because what you would cause is hyperinflation, where you'd need a wheelbarrow full of cash to buy a loaf of bread. Because by giving that much money, that massive influx, and that would jumpstart the economy, jumpstart it right to make us look like Zimbabwe. But, you know, it, I guess it could work.
It'd be several $1 trillion, wouldn't it?
It'd be hundreds of trillions of dollars. If you gave
$308 million, right?
You
now?
Give everyone $1 million, we're at 310,000 people.
That's 6 zeros.
310 million people. So while we're going to take a break right here while Jake does his ciphering. Rick, 1-888-520-7425. If you want to cipher along with us, check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Remember, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
If you were injured at work, do you think you would need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
2-2.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Now say you mean what I'm wondering, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of thing that money just can't buy.
That's true. Money just in this election cycle didn't buy much love, especially if you're Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman spent $142 million out of her own pocket and lost. You look at in Connecticut, for instance, the Republican senatorial candidate, railroad magnate Linda McMahon. She pile drove $47 million of her own cash into the ground, $90 a vote. She spent 90 bucks a vote. And let's not forget Republican from California, Carly Farina. She spent $5.5 million only to lose to Barbara Boxer. The only big money person that won, Rick Scott, the health guy down in Texas, who, from all reports that I've read, a criminal, a guy who cheated people out of billions of dollars. Well, and he's now the governor of Texas.
Texas is maybe right now close to the most Republican state in the country. Close.
Well, no, Pennsylvania is.
Not really.
But here's the thing. I think Progress has done a great job of bringing out the International Chamber of Commerce money. In fact, they're saying that the International Chamber spent $75 million in this campaign cycle. Found... Think Progress from that, where the International Chamber of Commerce spent money on races, they won 63% of the races. 20 incumbent Democrats were defeated because of the money that they threw out. In fact, they threw a whole bunch of money into Pat Toomey. They're saying about $1.7 million. So, you know, they got their money's worth, and they're going to get their money's worth because he's their guy. And, you know, what's worrying me is our system, our political system as a whole, to be honest, is being bought and paid for by the highest bidder. I don't think this Republican Congress, and I don't think the teabaggers, because this is an issue I think I agree with, I can come to an agreement with some teabaggers, that money has perverted the system, that we do want politics back at the personal level, at the local level, where voters are in charge, where small donors are important. I've had a bunch of people call me and say, well, Obama, you know, Obama spent a lot of money. Yeah, Obama spent a lot of money because a lot of people gave him very small donations.
Yes.
In fact, the most percentage-wise, since World War II, since they've been really keeping records on this, the most small donations coming from, actual people. So while he did spend a lot of money and he did get a lot of Wall Street money, it was also a lot of money from small individual donations.
A lot of it was $50 or less.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Because very few people can reach into their pocket, pull out $142 million to just...
No. I mean, we talk about the Sustack Toomey race. You remember the chamber commercials accusing him of supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, and according to their so-called independent study, it cost Pennsylvania over 500,000 jobs, even though the bill never came up. The bill was never voted on and never became an eventuality. According to them, it would have cost Pennsylvania over 500,000 jobs. It's not only is money just overwhelming the system, right? There's no accountability. I mean, what can you do when you make up these numbers? I mean, who do you go to? And even if there was adequate laws after the fact and they fine them, you still lose.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of these commercials were just, I mean, they just made up things. Absolutely made up things.
And what better way to run a country? No, look, at the end of this, you know, I do believe there should be a 28th Amendment to the Constitution where we go back and we say, I'm sorry, but corporations are not people. And we're not going to allow, I mean, even the state of Texas says that corporations shouldn't be giving money to candidates. Which is why Tom DeLay is on trial right now. Look, they're not people. They should not be given First Amendment rights. They should not be given constitutional rights that you and I have. Because we can't kill them. We can't throw a corporation in jail. I guess we could put them out of business, but that's never going to happen.
You know, a good question, Rick. And I don't know the answer. Maybe you do. I would think that the chamber would look at some of the Tea Party candidates with the jaundiced eye. How much money from the chamber went into Tea Party endorsed candidates or Tea Party candidates?
Well, we have no idea of knowing because there are no disclosure requirements. But if you look at the Tea Party money that came from the Tea Party Express, most of that was Koch brother money. Most of that was billionaire money. So you could probably
independent money.
Well, you could probably, you know, say that while the chamber stayed away from it, the same people who fund the chamber also funded the Tea Party. And there are two very distinct groups when you're talking about the Tea Party. Look, there is a grassroots movement of handfuls. Very disorganized, very decentralized, but handfuls of people that could add up to a substantial number. The organized part of this, the part of that I get press releases from ad nauseum, those folks are very well funded. Those folks are loaded to the gills. And, you know, the people like Americans for Prosperity.
Yes.
And Freedom Works. These are folks who have big bucks. And they're out and they've done it. They've done a great job of convincing Democratic voters to stay home and Republican voters to go out en masse. They were able to probably bring some new voters in, much like Obama was able to do in 2008, people who had not voted before. Because look, times are tough. And this president didn't do enough, in my opinion, did not do enough to inform the citizens every step of the way. And I go back early into his presidency, Jake, and we had talked about this when it happened, that I thought he got rabbit ears because he was doing some primetime stuff. He was out there doing, I think it was like almost every week he was doing a primetime press conference. And the Republicans were out there going, oh, well, wow. he's doing too much of this. And he got rabbit ears, and he stopped.
He hadn't at that point acclimated himself to his job as a president. I think he reacted too much like he always has. There's a big leap in procedure. There's a big leap in, I think, mental attitude that you have to make. There's an adjustment, clearly an adjustment, from Senate where you're one of 100 to the President of the United States. Now you're out there leading the band.
Yep.
You're not back there playing a tuba. Now you're leading the band.
You've got the stick.
Big,
you've got
that's
the
right. It starts with you. You are the big enchilada. You are number one. And I think you're absolutely right. He let them kind of steal the ball.
And you look,
if that's
gonna,
a proper metaphor.
You look what's going to happen here in Pennsylvania. Do you really think that the Republicans, who now control everything, are going to ask for the Democrats' input? I don't think so. What we're going to see is bill proposed, bill passed, bill signed. And that's what I thought Obama should have done from the beginning. Look, here's our health care bill. This is where we're starting. Boom, done. Next. And gone down, because you knew he was going to take a beating in the midterm anyway. We had talked about that from the beginning. You knew it was coming. You could not keep what you had.
Well, but
because historically you do. You always lose in the midterm.
But this, other than the Great Depression, was the greatest almost total collapse of the economy, other than the Great Depression. So it wasn't a typical election. It was just probably exaggerated two-threefold.
Well, I mean, the times, the fact that we are struggling, the fact that we've got near 10% unemployment, the fact that we've had people on unemployment for 2 years now, that in and of itself is enough to make people angry, and is enough to get people fired up and enraged.
And maybe I do this too. You and I we're not insiders, but we do know the facts. And we know that, you know, at one time we were losing over 700,000 jobs a month. And now we're creating a few. But if you're unemployed, if you don't have a job, are we really talking down to them to say, hey, look, why are you upset? We're going in the right direction. Hold on. Things are better for a lot of people.
But
that individual doesn't have a job, maybe can't provide for his family.
They were told that things were going to change. The media structure in this country set the bar so high, which is why you're seeing Republicans right now saying, well, you know, we know this isn't a mandate, and we're going to have to work, and we got lots to do, and I love this one. I just saw it today that, you know, we're going to repeal health care, just not right away. So they're already laying the groundwork for going, well, you know, we made that pledge, you know, the pledge. You know the pledge I'm holding in my hand, the 48 pages with 27 pages of pictures? Yeah, that pledge. The pledge that said we're going to repeal health care? Well, maybe not away.
Well, how many times have we said the Republicans play the game better than the Democrats?
They do.
And they do, and they're doing it again. They realize, hey, the rules have changed. You know, the night of the election, after the results were in, the rules changed. We can't be the party to know. We can't oppose everything. We have to rethink. We got to be smart, or we're going to lose again in 2012.
And that's what we've got to start looking at right now. How do we begin the organization? How do we bring people together? Because, look, at the end of this, we failed to get out and vote. We failed at getting people to the polls. So now we're going to have to point out all of the things that the Tea Party and the Republican Party said that they were going to do. And we've got a nice 48-page pledge with 27 pages of pictures. I point that out because it's important. You know, it's a typical conservative book. Very light on substance, heavy on imagery. That's what they are, a very shallow party. And we're going to find that out because they have no new ideas. And what I talked about with their job plan is just rehashing supply-side voodoo Reaganomics.
Yes.
That's all it is. There's nothing new here. There's no new here. Nothing.
Bonner said it. Less government, less regulation, lower taxes.
And we see how well that's worked out. Do we not remember the huge gusher in the Gulf? No, I guess not. Do we not remember September 2008 when the economy completely collapsed? I guess not. Do we not remember what caused that? Actually, no, we don't know what caused it. It was Wall Street. And why don't we know it was Wall Street? Because the media never got into it. It was a derivative. And most people don't even know what a derivative is. It was a mortgage-backed security. A what? It was a credit default swap. Oh, yeah. No, what it was is we said, here, Wall Street, here's all of our money. Go to the casino. Gamble your life. Gamble, get drunk. Hookers, do whatever you got to do. Spend as much, and we'll cover it. We got your back. We'll pick up the tab. In fact, we'll even pay for the shot when you get VD. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK. Right back.
USA. Drowning in crap and lies. Save the USA and resume the tax fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the
Saving Work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. SEIU Vice President Mitch Ackerman says the defeat of so many labor-backed U.S. House candidates was not a reflection of the true will of the majority of American voters, but the result of a concentrated corporate-funded campaign that capitalized on continuing economic pain.
This is the result of an unprecedented amount of unregulated, unreported corporate cash in these elections. This is not some sort of groundswell of enthusiasm for Tea Party and right-wing candidates.
Ackerman says despite the losses in the U.S. House, workers and their unions will continue to fight for what all workers want.
People voted for change 2 years ago pretty overwhelmingly, and it's not like the ideology of American voters switched 180 degrees in 2 years. It's that people are still hurting, and, you know, they're going to keep seeking ways to get some relief to the pain, and we're going to be out there trying to hold politicians accountable to creating good jobs in our community, to putting people back to work in the kinds of jobs that can support a family and help people send their kids to college and help us retire with dignity. And that's what working people want.
Ackerman says SEIU's national political effort scored some success in turning out the vote.
Places like Colorado, when we're celebrating the victory of John Hickenlooper for the governor's race. We did it in Nevada. Where, of course, the race was just called for Harry Reid. We did it in California. We did it in Arizona.
The National Labor Relations Board believes the Regis hair salon chain violated federal labor laws over potential anti-union activities. Jesse Russell reports.
The company's CEO, Paul Finkelstein, produced a DVD for employees in which he threatened the closure of salons if employees voted in favor of union representation, and he even went as far as telling workers they would be blacklisted in the salon industry. Posters were placed at salons encouraging employees to call a hotline if coworkers observed union activities. And the company even asked employees to sign pledges to not sign union cards. Regis has 12,700 salons around the world, making it the largest. Storefronts include Cost Cutters, Mastercuts, and a number of beauty schools.
Now that the state of New Jersey has rejected the ARC tunnel and the federal government has $3.3 billion to invest somewhere else, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is trying to arrange for it all to end up in New York State. In a letter to Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, Gillibrand asks for the money to be invested into the Second Avenue subway project in Manhattan. Part of that project will require the MTA to invest in upgrading the infrastructure of 51 buildings along the subway's line. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
The elections are over, and now the consequences begin, folks. And for those that actually read the words of the 48-page glossy pledge, you'll know there were no new ideas, no new vision, just 27 pages of smiling white people smiling at other white folks. And the question is, do we really know and do we understand what's next? What are the consequences for progressives staying home and pretty much handing the keys to the proverbial car back to the drunk driver? That's why I've asked Adam Hirsch. He's an economist at the Center for American Progress. Come talk to us. He wrote a piece recently, The Consequences of Conservative Economic Policy, a tried and failed approach that should not be repeated, but evidently looks like we're going to be heading down that path. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rick. Happy to be here.
You know, I'm looking at what happened yesterday, and I go, it's like deja vu all over again.
Yeah, well, I think voters sent out a message what they think is important, and exit polls show that 62% of voters, the economy, jobs was the number one issue. The question is now that the Republicans have won big across the country, whether they're going to be able to deliver the growth, deliver the jobs that they've been promising. And if the past is any prelude, it doesn't look good for that. So.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I've been reading stories that corporate America has been hoarding about $1 trillion, that they're sitting on all this cash. And the Republican line has been The reason that they're not using that $1 trillion to create jobs is because, well, they're uncertain. They're uncertain about taxes. They're uncertain about regulation. So I'm saying starting today, those jobs should be free-flowing because there's no uncertainty left.
Well, I think the uncertainty is definitely a factor in why businesses are sitting on cash instead of investing it in hiring workers and why banks aren't lending all this cash that they're sitting on. But the uncertainty isn't really about the regulation. It's about whether there are going to be customers out there to buy the goods and services and to repay the loans that the businesses can be making. And that uncertainty is something that's been created really in the past 2 years by Republicans in Congress that have been obstructing all efforts to get the economy going again, the efforts to get employment up again. And that's not really clear that that uncertainty is going to change in this after the midterm election. You know, the question now that the Republicans have won big is whether they're going to be able to put the country first or whether they're going to keep trying to obstruct the economic recovery to set themselves up for the 2012 election.
Well, what I'm assuming is I'm going to take them at their word. John Boehner has said no compromise unless the president's going to do what we want him to do. And Mitch McConnell has said his first order of business is getting someone else elected in 2012. So I'm not so sure that there's going to be much done over the next 2 years other than gridlock, obstruct, and, of course, investigate.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, we see other parts of our government are bracing for that continued gridlock. The Federal Reserve, you know, not all the economy is resting on the shoulders of the Congress and the president, but the Federal Reserve has recognized that this gridlock is a problem, and they're ready to take big action with some new monetary policy, quantitative easing, to try to get the economy going again where the gridlock in Congress has prevented the action that's needed to get people back to work to support the fledgling private sector economic recovery.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Adam Hirsch, economist for the Center for American Progress. You know, I got to tell you, one of the things that I keep hearing, and I want to talk about maybe what's going to happen in the future, because the Republicans have said tax cuts. They want more tax cuts. And I look back to the Bush years. If tax cuts were the panacea, should not the Bush years have been one of the hottest economies this country has ever seen? And if it is the panacea, show me the jobs.
Yeah, well, the Bush years had a one-note symphony of economic policy. It was tax cuts slanted at rich Americans. And what we saw is, and through the Bush years, we had the weakest economic recovery in the history of the post-war economy in the United States. So after the very relatively shallow 2001 recession, we had more tax cuts, and the economy trickled along in what we were calling at that time the jobless economic recovery. Business investment was really low. The employment rates were really low. Family incomes were stagnating or going down. So the tax cuts didn't really get us back on track in the economy. But what they did was they left the economy really weak and and the failure to address other problems that were building up in the economy led to this crisis that we're in now. So those policies of tax cutting planted at the very richest of rich Americans, they're what helped get us into this mess. And now that the Republicans have taken over the House, made gains in the Senate, made gains in state legislatures and governors, they're looking back to the tax cuts as a way to move us forward. But it's really just going backwards because we're going to return to low growth, jobless economic recovery. It's going to be trouble ahead.
You know, Adam, I've been saying for a while that, you know, all these tax handouts for the very wealthy, basically, you know, propping them up. My concern is that the Republicans seem to be the party of tough love, and all these folks who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own, they're not going to see any extensions to unemployment benefits. And I'm concerned what that's going to do to our economy because, you know, as an economist, maybe you can speak to it better than I can, but it's those type of elastic programs, that elasticity that has kept us really from collapsing as an economy and kept consumer spending up a little bit because those people are spending that money.
I think that's right, Rick. And when the Census Bureau came out with the poverty numbers in last month, what they showed was that unemployment insurance benefits helped 3.3 million families stay out of poverty. This is one of the most effective tools we have for keeping consumption up in the economy to support economic growth. And unfortunately, it's one that the Republicans have wanted to play politics with. You know, we have huge unemployment right now, 9.6% unemployment, about 14 million people unemployed, and almost half of those are long-time unemployed. That means they've been unemployed for more than 26 weeks. 26 weeks is what, under normal statute, people who are out of work through no fault of their own get for normal unemployment benefits. We've seen through the past 2 years that the Republicans have wanted to play politics with extending the unemployment insurance benefits for people that are out of work for a long time. Twice, while President Bush was still in office in 2008, the Congress reauthorized unemployment insurance benefits on almost a unanimous vote. It was like 90-92%. But as soon as President Obama was in office, all of a sudden this became a political tool for Republicans to use against the president and the Democrats. They held it up. They filibustered it. Unemployment insurance benefits actually lapsed at one point over the summer. And I think the first test we'll see coming up this month in November is that the unemployment will need to be reauthorized before November 30th, or people are going to be thrown off their unemployment benefits right before the holidays.
Well, here's the good thing. And there's a good thing in this, and the Republicans can claim victory. If you throw all those people off, you know, tough love, because you remember, got to have tough love. If we throw all these people off, the unemployment rate goes down.
Yeah, well, and the numbers, they may go down because people will be so frustrated not being able to find a job in the private economy that they're just going to stop, give up looking. But that may be good in the headlines for the Republicans, but obviously that's bad for, you know, American people.
Well, I got to be honest. I truly believe, and maybe this tough love is what we need, because I believe that things only change when people are hurting. You know, maybe like the old saying, you know, when your stomach's empty, maybe your head gets right. And maybe that's what we need, because I don't think the president made the sell that the economy could have collapsed and it could have been much worse. I don't think people believe that it could have been worse than it was.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rick. And we see in this election is that people are upset and about frustrated about the pace of change in the economy and improving the economy. And, well.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. The last line of question before I let you go here. You know, I've been getting this frame from some listeners that we need more tax cuts because it's my money and I can spend my money better than that government can. I'm curious how you would respond to that, because I've said, look, you know, as a member of society, we have to pay for the things that we use, like the roads we drive on, the schools we send our kids to, and if we want good roads and schools, we've got to adequately fund that stuff. But there's this frame out here that it's my money and I'll spend it better than those people can. So I'm curious how you'd respond to that.
Well, I think it's important that the money we spend as a society through our government, that we spend it effectively and efficiently on the things that the services that people need and the things that are going to increase our capacity for long-run economic growth and productivity, things like infrastructure, things like investing in green energy industries of the future that are going to get us off our carbon addiction, education. And we have to pay for those things somehow, so we're going to continue to have taxes. But right now, it's not that it's our money that's not being spent. Some people are paying in, and other people are getting out quite a lot. And these are corporations and banks that are sitting on this big stockpile of cash, a big stockpile of bank reserves that our government has given out to them. Through the Federal Reserve and under the Bush administration TARP program for the banks. And we need them to get spending it so that people can be moved back into private employment.
What do you say to the frame, though, specifically, that the individual, me personally, Rick Smith, would spend, like George Bush handed me $300 a number of years ago and said, here, go be irresponsible. That's your war. That's your war call. What do you say to that? Mean that, that I'm going to spend that $300 better than our government would?
Well, for most people, you know, we've seen household debt levels go up very high in the late 2000s as people were struggling to keep up with stalled family income. And now a lot of people underwater with their housing mortgages. So we give more money to people, they're going to turn around and give it to the banks and pay it back with the debt service to the banks and the people that own their home mortgages. So the banks, we know, aren't lending money. They're just going to sit on that money and send it out to, you know, profit to their shareholders and to their CEOs. So I don't think that that's going to be a really effective way to get money going in the economy again.
I agree. Adam Hirsch, I appreciate your time again. The article is The Consequences of Conservative Economic Policy. We'll put a link over at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Adam, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. Be back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
That's one place I won't be. I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern. Sing a little bit of these working.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
What is this? Yeah, raise your hands up. There you go. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. One of the crazier things that I think I've heard in this election cycle from the Republicans comes from this Cynthia Loomis. Raw Story writes, the struggling economy has been rough on many Americans, but it's been exceptionally rough on the rich, especially the rich people in Wyoming, according to the state's lone House representative. Republican Cynthia Loomis claimed in a news conference that the possible return of the estate tax is going to cause some of her constituents to kill themselves. They're going to commit suicide because they just can't pay the thing. She didn't, no names, again, like a good Republican, no facts, heavy on allegation, light on actual facts. The Associated Press reports that Loomis said some of the elderly estate owners in Wyoming are plotting to go off life support or seek life-ending medical treatments. Wait a minute. Life-ending medical treatments. Does that kind of seem dumb to you? It seems kind of dumb to me. But think about this. She's actually running on the platform of, we've got to do something about the estate tax and let it, you know, just do away with it. Because there are people on life support who are deciding to die so they don't have to pay it. So they can be they can leave all their money to the next generation. Is that's got to be one of the dumbest things I've ever heard.
Makes no sense. If I was running against her, I'd say, okay, give me one person. Bring that person forward. Let them testify about it, of how bad their life is, of how torturous it is because of their thinking how much money they might have to lose.
So I got to ask the question then, yeah, because Wyoming's a pretty Republican state. Do they have euthanasia? Can they have? I mean, is it possible to have life-ending medical treatments? I honestly don't know. She said, quote, if you have spent your whole life building a ranch and you want to pass your estate on to your children, and you were 88 years old and on dialysis, and the only thing that was keeping you alive was dialysis, you might make the same decision. Dialysis? Really? I know people live for several years on dialysis. You're going to end your life because you want to save a couple of bucks on taxes? Really? Really? And you know what's funny about the estate tax? Is I've got guys that I've worked with over the years who go, oh, you know, the death tax. I think that's wrong. That's wrong because I shouldn't have to pay taxes when I'm dead. And I go, really? You've got $2.5 million in the bank? Well, no. And then what are you worrying about? You're not paying it. What do you mean? It's only if you reach a certain threshold. And then you pay taxes on what's above that, not what's below it. And do you know who passed it? It was a Republican. A good Republican. Well, sort of a good Republican. I mean, he wasn't as bad as he could have been. Teddy Roosevelt was a, you know, for his faults of the time. You know, and I had someone from Japan email me recently telling me that, you know, listing, and I appreciate the email, but listing the negatives to Teddy Roosevelt, because I think he was all right because he was a trust buster.
He was a reformer. He was also an environmentalist, if I remember. For his time.
For his time. But, you know, at the end of this, you know, I'm stopping and thinking, I'm going, it was Republican Congress to pass, the Republican president signed it. It was to stop having a billionaire class. Because remember, we were coming out of the late 1800s, where you had these big railroad magnates. You had these very powerful families, you know, Rockefellers and such.
Morgans.
Morgans and Goulds and, you know, all of them. And we wanted to somehow control that, bring that power down. Because if you have all this wealth, if you have this accumulated wealth, you're going to use it to do what? Exactly what corporations are doing right now. By elections and by politicians. And that's what they did back then. So this was a smart, courageous piece of legislation at the time, and it's something that we've had all these years and has served us well. But again, you know, the wealth class in this country has got one of the political parties in their back pocket, and again, we've got to go through this debate.
Now, what would your Republican Party call Teddy today? Left-wing Looney Tune, perhaps?
Well, by today's standards, he'd be right sitting next to Ralph Nader. You know, he'd be over there with Nader going, sorry, both parties left us behind. We're insane, according to the... I mean, because you think of how far the political process, the whole spectrum has just up and moved. You know, they keep moving the goalposts. I mean, it's amazing, amazing stuff. And here's the thing, and get ready for it, because it is coming. Daryl Issa said this week, a Republican from California, quote, I will be asking the president to give subpoena authority to all 74 inspector generals. I'll offer a bill this coming or 2 weeks from now to do just that, because I think it's the government employees, the IGs, inspector generals, that are so important. That they do their job so this administration can be better, and I look forward to strengthening those internal controls. He also told reporters, I want to prove the pundits wrong. My job not to bring down the president. My job is to make sure the president is a success. Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah, that's it. We're going to make him a better president. Yeah, while we put him on trial for impeachment. Yeah, that's the ticket. While we investigate him going to the bathroom. Yeah, that's the ticket. I mean, stop and think about this for a minute. Think about the the stones it takes to make that kind of statement. When everybody knows ICE has got a, well, I can't say that word either. The 4 hour thing that you take, you get when you have Viagra. How's that? Is that an image for you? Where they keep warning you at the end of the Viagra commercials, if this lasts for 4 hours, see a doc. Well, that's what ICE has got. In fact, it's not just the 4 hour kind, it's like the 40 year kind. But here's the thing. You know this guy's got it in for the president. You know he's going to investigate. They're going to go after every single thing. And to be honest, I don't know if there's anything to find. I doubt it. But we're going to find out. And we may even find out what kind of toothpaste the president uses. We'll find out what kind of doggy treats little Bo eats. We'll find out all that stuff. Because that's what Republicans do. You know, I was in the diner the other day and having breakfast with the family. And there was this older family sitting behind me. And they were talking about Monica Lewinsky and the cigar and the whole, you know, the woman said, well, you know, the president didn't have sex with Monica Lewinsky. His cigar did. And I'm going, do we really need to know that as a country? Did we need to know that? But thanks to the Republicans, we do. Because that's what they do. So you know what? I'm waiting for the next pornographic investigation report to come out, much like the last one. That we only spent, what did we spend, $45 million? $45 million to investigate fellatio. Interesting. Interesting. And that isn't wasteful government. That isn't fraudulent. That isn't abuse.
If you remember the... our local congressman here, before Tim Holden took over, George Gekas, he was on that committee and for a solid year. I mean, George Gekas' head was so big, it was amazing he could get into the meeting room because he was on national TV. And what came out of it? All they did, and here's where I really hold Bill Clinton responsible. Is it ridiculous what they were investigating? Yes. But he allowed the Republicans to basically not have to address the real serious issues of this country for a solid year. And the question was, did he lie under oath about sex outside of marriage? I mean, I often thought about that, and that's the one thing
That's it? That's the only thing you can come up with?
No, that's one thing I hold Bill Clinton responsible for, that he allowed the Republicans to do that to him. And to the country, really. It's not to him, it's to the country.
I was going to say, if that's the only thing you can find with, the only flaw you can find with Clinton, we've got some things to talk about.
No. I know you have several.
I do.
Big issues.
Also from the UK Guardian, on election night, there for some of the crankier candidates, an eccentric proposal was also rejected in the polls in Denver, Colorado, as the people of Denver opted against an initiative to track aliens from outer space. This is why there's part of me that likes this initiative and referendum thing. That you get votes on, should we track aliens from outer space? The proposal known as Initiative 300 would have involved setting up a commission to monitor aliens and a website to allow members of the public to report UFO sightings. It called on voters to, quote, adapt and initiated an ordinance to require the creation of an extraterrestrial affairs commission to help ensure the health, safety, and cultural awareness of Denver residents and visitors in relation to potential encounters or interaction with extraterrestrial intelligent beings or their vehicles. I think too many people have spent too much time claiming they were abducted and probed.
They're watching the Twilight Zone too often.
I actually knew a guy who claimed, why is it that all these folks think that, you know, they were abducted? They're the special one. They got taken up into the ship and probed. And why is it always probed from behind? You know, could it have been just a drunken night where, you know, you ended up in the wrong bar? I don't know. But it seems like that seems to be the common thread. We went up into the ship and we were probed. I don't know. Anyway, there were 80% of the voters there in Denver rejected the idea. So the good thing is there were 80% of the same people. Amazingly, 20% voted for it. And that's why I love these initiatives and these referendums. The problem is they're wildly expensive and really, honestly, and truthfully, can be, if you get somebody with big money behind it, dangerous, especially in a state like Pennsylvania where we're constantly under attack to protect workers' rights, to protect the prevailing wage, to protect the state liquor stores. Amazing, amazing stuff. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. And remember, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
There's one especially ugly word that an author never wants to hear. Pulp. To pulp a book is not merely to remove it from sale, but literally to destroy it, reducing the paper itself and all of your words and thoughts to a goopy chemical mash. I've had one of my books threatened with pulping even before it went on sale, so I can empathize with Anthony Schaefer, who has just had the first printing of his book gooped by a gang of goofy censors in the Pentagon. Schaefer, a lieutenant colonel who served as an Army intelligence officer in Afghanistan, had written Operation Dark Heart, an unflattering assessment of America's military intelligence bureaucracy. Playing by the rules, Colonel Schaefer had dutifully submitted his manuscript to the Army prior to publication, getting its official approval in January to publish. So, 10,000 copies were printed and placed in a distribution warehouse. About 100 advance copies were sent to book reviewers. And Schaefer even received the endorsement of a former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency who hailed the memoir as, quote, one terrific book. But in July, the goofiness hit the fan. Someone in DIA began objecting to Schaefer's critique, and suddenly some 250 passages were deemed to contain military secrets. These so-called secrets were mostly well-known facts already published in news articles, Wikipedia, and elsewhere. But Schaefer's permission to publish was abruptly retracted. The Pentagon brass then bought the 10,000 warehouse copies and, in the overbearing name of national security, had them pulped. This is Jim Hightower saying, the pulping merely proves Schaefer's point about the heavy-handed stupidity of the military intelligence establishment, while also showing, once again, that the Pentagon brass has way too many of our tax dollars to play with.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I gotta wonder if when Tom DeLay goes to prison, when the hammer goes to prison, if he's gonna meet the sledgehammer.
Or if he can dance as well as he does dancing with the stars.
Yeah, well, dance, Tom. Put on this dress and dance for us. And that will be a fitting punishment. It still won't clean up all the mess that he made, but it will be a fitting punishment to be, anyway. Anyway, in October, the reports are out, employers added 43,000 private sector jobs. And what I'm saying is, look, you know, we saw the recovery working. We spent the money wisely. Even I didn't think it was enough. I thought we should have spent more. I thought the stimulus should have been bigger. But we're starting to see some of it coming out of it. So in October, 43,000 jobs. So November now, we should create at least 1 million jobs. Easily. because, you know, all those people who were afraid to create jobs, they don't have to worry about things. There'll be no tax increases. There'll be no regulations. We're not going to put any new regulations on people. And, you know, they're going to be able to be freewheelers, do whatever they want to do, thanks to the Republicans taking over. So the job creation should be there. We should have no problem from this point forward. And if it doesn't happen, it's because their ideology is a failure. And I'm saying it's a failure right now because we've learned this lesson over and over and over and over and over again. I don't know how many times we've got to go back. Because this pledge, this create jobs pledge, this thing ain't working. Sorry, didn't work during the Reagan years, didn't work during the Shrub years. But oddly enough, you know what did work? And you go back to the Clinton years. And I beat up on Clinton for a lot of things. There were things I think he could have done better. There are things he could have done smarter. But you go back to the Clinton years, he raised that top marginal tax rate. And you know what it did? It began to balance the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Why? There was more money coming in from the people who had it. See, you can't, and this is where, Jake, I do agree with the Tea Party people. I do agree with the tea concept. People like you and I, we are taxed enough already. I do agree with that wholeheartedly. My problem is that you have a billionaire class who, for the most part, are able to walk away scot-free because they're not creating jobs. We love to think that they're going to, that they're going to find these opportunities out there and that they're going to give money to all these small entrepreneurs who are going to go out there and create the next Microsoft. That ain't happening. You know where the investment's happening? China. You know where the investment's happening? India, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, Guatemala, everywhere but here. Why? Because we have open borders. So you can produce those products everywhere around the world and bring them back in here. That's a beautiful thing, I think. It gets us really cheap goods, doesn't it? The problem is cheap goods don't do you much good if you have no wages. Just like tax cuts. Tax cuts sound great, but what about the guy who doesn't have a job? Is he going to be able to feed his family tax cuts? No, I don't think so. So what I'm interested to see here in a couple of weeks, this whole discussion is going to come back about extending unemployment again. And do the Republicans stick to their tough love logic? Do they stick to, there are jobs out there, buddy, go get one? Do you think they're going to stick to that?
This will be the first issue after the election. It'll be interesting to see what they do.
I got to be honest. I think they're gonna stick to their tough love early. Because there's still 2 years for them to hope that people forget. And you know what? Maybe they will. I mean, we forgot September of 2008 already. We forgot how bad the economic crisis was. We forgot the 700,000 job losses. We forgot that. So, you know, part of me thinks they're gonna take that stand. We're going to lower the unemployment rate almost immediately because we're going to kick all those people off unemployment. So there'll be no extensions. So it ought to be interesting. And I'm ready for the fight. I'm actually geared up. Last night I walked out of here was a little down because I did hope, the only hope I had for last night was that in Pennsylvania we'd have kept at least one seat in the House, that the Democrats would have controlled at least by one seat so that we could have done some things to halt the redistricting that's going to happen. Because when that happens, we're in big trouble. Because you think the districts look funky now? You think that little cutout where I'm at, where they just take my little neighborhood and nobody else around me, because I live with a bunch of Republicans, you think that's weird? Wait till you see the next one that's coming out, especially because we're losing a seat.
Isn't it ironic that one of the few Republicans in the House, maybe the only one to lose his job, was John Purcell?
Well, he was going to go to jail anyway.
But he wouldn't be the first one under indictment or even convicted won. He was pretty popular over the years. And, of course,
evidently not last night. Well, Todd Eaches lost. And, you know, some people were saying, well, you know, Eaches may have been under indictment soon. So,
well, not only that, I've been told he didn't particularly run a good campaign. He refused to debate. That's not good. Especially in today's
work for Joe Pitts.
Yeah, but the numbers in his district are a lot better.
Yeah, the pitster down there, he doesn't like the debate either. Because he's got, like you said, he's got it nice. Same thing with Schuster. You know, I don't think.
Oh, Schuster's even more safe.
I finally saw one sign for my congressman. He actually spent the buck to build to have one sign, I think. Why? Because he knows that the minions are going to go to the polls and they're going to mindlessly pull the Republican lever. In this area, honestly and truthfully, look, what has he brought back to the district? What has he done? Nothing. At least his old man was the Asphalt King.
Name. Yes, he was.
I mean, I can understand him. He, you know, the Asphalt King did get a lot of work done.
He was the Pork King. Was a legend, absolutely was.
He sure was. And now the kids got the name, and that's all that people remember. Oh, yeah, I know that. But we're going to see. We are going to see what this 112th Congress looks like. And there are over 100 freshman Republican going to take seats here in the 112th. But some of the things that I find interesting, of the more than 100 Republicans that are going to be taking these seats, 50% of them denied the existence of man-made climate change. 86% of them are opposed to any climate change legislation. Nothing. They want no part of it. 39% have already declared their intention to end the 14th Amendment's birthright guarantee. And 32% want to reduce legal immigration. So I got to be honest. I don't know if that's a great thing to do. We do need a workforce coming in. We do need... look, the baby boom generation is not getting younger. You're going to need workers to replace them. You're going to need someone to wipe their noses. You're going to need someone to diaper them. And while David Vitter isn't old enough yet to partake in that, that's why he has to pay, you know, ladies of the evening to help him with his diaper habit. A lot of senior citizens, they're going to need that help. You know, it is just what it is. And the other thing, taxes and spending, 91% have sworn to never, never allow an income tax increase or any individual or business, regardless of deficit or war. So we got a whole bunch of Bushies walking around. The Bushies are back.
Wow.
79% have pledged to permanently repeal the estate tax, and 48% have pushed for a balanced budget amendment. And here's what's interesting about all that. In times like these, in economic times like these, if you don't have the ability to deficit spend, you will collapse. If you don't have the ability to use fiscal monetary policy to get your economy moving again, you will continue to spiral and collapse. And, you know, I'm hoping this doesn't happen, but we've been down this road before. History has taught us that when we start cutting spending at a time of crisis, it causes more crisis. And it's like anything. You know, you start down the wrong path, you do the wrong things, and this is what you end up with. And look, we cannot give up any revenue streams right now. I'm sorry, the estate tax has to be back at least to where it was. So that we generate, they're talking about $10 billion over the next couple of years. It's a lot of money. Where is that going to come from? Well, if it doesn't come from the top, it's going to come from you. Or it's going to come from me. Or it's going to come from people who work for a living. Can we do that? Look, I'd love to have these talks about taxes. And I've been emailing a couple of people about, you know, what would we do? I have some people who say we should pay no tax at all. Government should provide no services. Government should do nothing. It should be all the private sector, and we should pay for every service we get. I think you'd end up getting corporate tunnel at the end of the day by writing all these checks. But then there are some folks who say, well, we need to spend our money better. And that I think we can find some common ground on. There is a lot of spending out there that I don't agree with. But the other side of that coin is a lot of spending that people do agree with. I think the money we're spending on the military, the massive amounts of money that we're pouring into Afghanistan and into Iraq, and now the right wants us to get into Iran, I think that's a bad idea.
Well, you and I both know some of that's just part of the problem stems from the political process, where many times they will pass, if it's an appropriation for planes, many times they'll pass an appropriation instead of for 500, they'll pass for 750, so that part of that work, which will emanate from their district, you know, their constituents will get, so they can get the credit and get reelected. That's part of the problem, too.
Well, that is part of the problem. But here's the reality. If you're spending that $500 billion on something else, it's still going into your district. Why does it have to be on planes the military doesn't want, or on outdated weapons
systems?
That's
right. It's something we don't need.
Why can't it be something useful?
I agree.
And look, I'm not against spending. I never have been.
Why don't we put that in infrastructure, something permanent that will create jobs and also provide a service and also improve our economy?
You know, I look at where my daughter goes to school. They put up that solar array. To me, it's a no-brainer.
That's a no-brainer.
You do that. That's investing. That's leaving something for her children.
Do you know how much that cost the district, right?
It didn't cost the district anything. I think they got grant money from the state and the federal government.
Well, then I guess I guess my question is, why don't we have more of those grants? Because obviously, for every dollar invested, it sounds like you're making considerably more than $1.
Well, I mean,
for
every dollar that we invest in it, the district is not raising my school taxes. They're not raising property taxes on the people in our community, which is a smart thing because they're not paying an electric bill anymore. They're actually selling electricity back to the grid and helping all of us. I mean,
I'd like to know the multiplier factor on that.
I'm going to look into that because I'd like to get the superintendent of the school district, and I may do that. That's probably not a bad
idea. I mean, as good as that sounds, it might actually pay some school districts to loan that money.
I think the state and the federal government should be saying, look, you know, every federal building, every state building, we're going to put this stuff, we're going to find ways to cut costs by investing in the future. Simple.
Not to mention you're putting people to work to make that.
Yep. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this to wrap things up. Remember, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. When 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity, some 80,000 workers workers turned out to support the eight-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, eight innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. Four of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rich Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
You're proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out our website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. How many people remember this guy?
Speaking that's totally for myself. I'm not speaking for the Republican Party. I'm not speaking for anybody in the House of Representatives but myself. But I'm ashamed of what happened in the White House yesterday. I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown.
How many people remember him? Remember his name? Joe Barton? Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Well, here's the irony of the consequences of our actions yesterday. He is the leading contender for the chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. That's the position he held once before during the 2004-2006 congressional session. Now, if you remember, the context of that was there's oil pouring into the Gulf of Mexico. Not just pouring. What would be a good adjective? What would be a great way of explaining that? A good verb? What would exploding? Spewing, what would be a good word for that?
Spewing's good.
So he had all this oil that was just pouring into the Gulf. And the president's going...
How about cascading?
No, that seems too nice. You think relaxation...
Erupting.
Erupt. There you go. There you go. That's a good one. Good phallic term. But again, there's a perfect... There you go. Perfect. It was erupting out of the ground. Perfect. I like it. But here's this guy who's complaining that President Obama said, look, folks, you guys have made a mess. We need some money to make sure that the people are made whole, that the fishermen are made whole, that the communities are made whole, and everything gets cleaned up. You need to ante up some money, put it in a pot, and make sure that it's there. Not that we have to fight you for it in a bunch of years. Not that we're going to have to take you to court for it. Not that we're going to have to do all that like we had to do with the Exxon Valdez. No. We want the money in a pot right now. And you got Barton here saying, well, you know, I apologize that I think you was shook down. A private corporation shook down by the White House. No. You're paying for the mess that you created. But this guy could be the head of the department that oversees this stuff.
I believe he tried to soften that statement a little bit later.
Oh, he backpedaled quickly. I'm surprised.
Well, we all know what he meant.
Yeah, we know what he meant. He was going, give me some more campaign donation.
Well, I'm sure the leadership said, you know, you got to take a little bit of the bite off that statement.
No. Yeah, but I mean, here's the thing, though. He apologized to an industry that was spewing millions of gallons of oil through their incompetence, through their negligence. You know.
Putting the foxes in charge of the hen house.
And that's what we've done. We've gone here. You know, good luck. In fact, another one we're looking at. This this is going to be a long, this is going to be a long couple of years. I'm telling you right now. It's going to be something that, scary stuff.
I don't know how the, truthfully, I mean, just my gut feeling. Only time will tell, but I think I'm right. I don't see how the Republican Party can really ignore these Tea Party-backed candidates, because they're going to be pushing for their agenda. You all in this show repeated their vows. They have vowed not to vote for certain legislation. Vowed never, ever, never. They've drawn a line of sand before they even got to Washington. Well, what does that tell you? That could be real problems for the Republican Party.
And I'm hoping it is. I'm hoping they eat themselves, and they finally, it finally happens what's happened to the Democratic Party. And look, I'm, if there were, honestly and truthfully, look, if there were Republicans who stood up and said, you know what, I think that in a capitalist country, labor has as much right to organize as capital does, I could see myself voting for a Republican. Because there are some, socially, I've got some, you know, some middle ground things, you know, I could be conservative in saying that people need to be responsible for themselves, mandating health care. I think that's a responsible position. You know, there's some things that I do agree with. But at the end of it, it's this absolute fawning over the free enterprise monopolistic system without any controls. That's what bothers me. I'm as much a capitalist as any working person can be. But at the end of it, don't we want some sane, rational controls? Don't we want to have labor be able to organize in the same mode that capital does? Why is it that the only, you know, like the sign that behind my head here says, you know, why is the right to die on the job the only free right freely granted to workers? Why is that? We don't have that problem with capital. And that makes a lot of sense to me. If you give me some pro-labor Republicans, I got no problem voting for them. And I'm hoping there's some in the House. Because if we go through and we want to privatize these liquor stores, which are great investments for this state, which are good tax generators for the taxpayers of this state, if we want to privatize that for a quick fix, we better start. We're starting the fight right now.
I was told tonight, maybe you can verify it, all of the state stores are worth around $200
million. Oh, no.
Or, I mean, $2 billion, I'm sorry.
$2 billion, yes.
$2 billion. So if you take the numbers we heard tonight.
Between 300 and 375.
375.
Okay, so let's say 300.
Let's take the conservative number. You're talking about 7 years.
Yep.
In 7 years, we will have given back what they're going to get in one. And then after that,
we
there's no more.
That's it. And the other part of this is, you know, it's like when I was a kid, you know, we used to be able to buy liquor in the stores. It was the 42-proof stuff. It was a watered-down vodka and a watered-down gin and watered-down stuff. You had to go to the actual state store to get the high-proof stuff. But you could buy wine and low... low voltage gin, right there at the 7-Eleven, right there at the grocery store.
Let's look at other states, Jersey and New York. They put, first of all, they tended to put them in poor neighborhoods where young kids bought it. Crime went up. Crimes involving alcohol or underage went up. I mean, there is a track record here. This situation in Pennsylvania, those who pushing for privatization. Like to say that, you know, we're an anomaly and we're in our own little vacuum. Well, that's not true. Our decisions are based on common sense and track record in other states.
Yep. All righty. Great show tonight. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here again tomorrow night, 9 o'clock. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy's
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.